Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, September 24th, 2018. We broadcast live every Monday night from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening in live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our access code is 449-389-pound. If anyone would like to email a question, you can email your questions to questions, it's plural questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, we're going to pick up in where we left off last week in the Gospel of John. We're going to read, we're in chapter 6. We'll read a few verses from 22 through 30. So John chapter 6, verses 22 through 30. So the day following, when the people which stood on the other side of the sea saw that there was none other boat there save that which entered, and that Jesus went not with the disciples into the boat, but that his disciples were gone away alone. Howbeit there came the other boats from Tiberias night unto the place where they did eat bread after that the Lord had given thanks. When the people therefore saw that Jesus was not there, neither his disciples, they also looked shipping and came to Capernaum, seeking for Jesus. And when they had found him on the other side of the sea, they said unto him, Rabbi, when camest thou hither? Jesus answered them and said, Truly, truly, I say unto you, ye seek me not because ye saw the miracles, but because ye did eat the loaves and were filled. Labor not for the meat which perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you, for him hath the Father God sealed. Then said they unto him, What shall we do, that we might work the works of God? Jesus answered and said unto them, This is the work of God, that you believe on him whom he hath sent. They said therefore unto him, What sign showest thou, then, that we may see and believe thee? What doest thou work? All right, I'm going to stop there. It's going to go quite lengthy, and but we'll pick up for the rest of that chapter. We'll probably finish that chapter off next week. Okay. Let's see. I don't particularly have a subject matter tonight. Kind of just woke up and running late. Thanks, Jan, for beeping me. But anyway, I guess we'll go right into questions or any comments or anything before we head out. Jan, do we have any questions? Or anybody has any comments or statements that need to be made?
Right. We have a number of questions tonight, John.
Uh-oh. Good.
The first one is, if the non-judicial cases don't make it through the Article III court, what are the steps one can take to make or file a non-judicial foreclosure on an individual level?
Well, they seem to be bent on not giving us Article III courts, and really, ultimately, we're looking, of course, for the Court of Justice, and not where a judge sits in, but where the people sit in. These non-judicial foreclosures ultimately, of course, take place in the lower courts, and we do need to challenge them on the upper courts for not giving us the due process, and that's where the challenge will be. But it's really going to take the pressure of the people. I think the paper we're going to write, we're just going to have to push it forward and push for these courts of justice. I think the timing is right for this. When you look to see what's going on in Washington, D.C., and what Trump is doing, I think the timing is just right. But it's going to be a little while before we get the filing on this paper. We're still working on it. But it's going to be quite lengthy, and it's going to cover quite a bit. But, of course, the key, the lawsuit, and we may want to discuss a little more on who we're going to sue. I was just thinking about the appellate court, which I guess would be, of course, on the level of the Supreme Court. Of course, it's in between the two, and how we're going to go about dealing with the appellate court. I haven't had any personal experiences in appellate court on the federal level. I don't know. I know that that Trump has put in, I don't remember how many, Gerard, do you remember how many judges he appointed down there in the appellate court in New York City? Because I know there's about 30.
I don't know what the exact number in New York was, but he sent like five new prosecutors in, and I don't know how many judges. I don't remember specifically to comment on.
All right, but we're kind of hoping that that the timing is right. And again, it's taken longer than we hoped. This paper is, I'm finding it a little difficult trying to put together myself and working on this paper. But hopefully, we'll get it done shortly, and we'll file it. It's going to take a little time to go through the system, and we'll see where they go. I mean, we know what they're doing with our New York case. It'll be very interesting to see if they do the same thing and just kind of stall us out. But the case in the New York case, which is a federal case in a federal court against the governor and the legislators here in New York concerning the gun laws, and particularly the latest events where they're trying to take all of the control of even the permits for weapons away from the sheriff and give it to the state police, of course, which makes it a political situation. But again, I think the timing is right. We've prepared the way. We've done so many papers here, and we filed them all in that latest court where we really have opened up for the purpose of depositing information and depositing any kind of a paperwork or an indictment that we might do up on the Northern District, and we're going to be filing this case again also on the Northern District. So they'll be hit with two cases from us up there, and it's just going to be interesting to see how they're going to handle that. Now, on the New York case, you know, they've been dragging their feet now since, what was it, I think it was June 19th they were supposed to answer, and they still haven't done anything. As a matter of fact, we should sit and think about whether we should write a letter and send it to the judge and find out, hey, what's going on? But anyway, we're going to have to see how it goes. But again, as far as getting a court and justice here in the United States, anyway, I don't know that it's even possible anymore. Again, you need to get a court that's untainted, that doesn't have a tainted jury. You have to go into a system where you're not paying money. The moment you're paying money, they call it the civil rights in those courts. They control the courts through statutes and not law. Of course, we're talking, looking for the natural law, not the law of man. Now, we have given them authority. We spoke about this many times already. We've given them the authority to write quite a bit of law. Matter of fact, there are 54 titles, I mean, that they have written of law, 27 of which, you know, has been, you know, turned into law, and it's called positive law, which is really law by man, which is what that means, positive law, law by human. And but the courts that we the people belong into for any purpose really is courts of law, which is common law courts. That's the desire. All right. Anyway, we're going to see how things go. I think by the beginning of the year, because we're coming up, let's see, September, coming into October, yeah, I'm kind of hoping we're going to get this case filed maybe in the beginning to the middle of October, and then we'll be in November, moving into December, before we see how they respond. But actually, the federal government, because we're going in after the federal government suing them, they got 60 days to respond. So if we file it in mid-October, let's say, we've got November, December, by mid-December, they're going to be required to give us an answer or, again, make their move for, you know, their Rule 12. You know, every time we look at this and see how they do things, we learn a little more about how they operate. We learn a little more about the things that they're going to hold up against us, and we get a little more knowledgeable in those areas. And I think if we make our case very strong, particularly looking at Rule 8, Rule 8 lays out, you know, the necessary things that you must really bring together to have a solid case in the federal court. And as long as we can really put that up front, they won't be able to turn to us and say, well, you know, again, you don't have a case because you failed to you know, make a claim or something under Rule 12. But we're going to kind of make that argument beforehand and make that part of the court case problem and part of the blockage of what these people are doing on how they use Rule 12 as a settle-all to maintain the status quo and keep us out of the courts. But it's going to be interesting to see how it goes forward. You know, suing the judiciary, they're going to have a problem, you know, and how they're going to deal with trying to place a judge at the head of the court. Again, I think we need to discuss our strategies a little more before we actually make the filing, and see once, you know, what positions we may hold as they try to do something to control the court. So it's just going to be interesting to see how that's going to go forward. All right. Anything else, Jim?
I think this was submitted by someone that already had us file a non-judicial foreclosure and they lost their home. So you're basically saying that there's nothing they can do on an individual level at that point?
Well, that's true. You know, we can file papers on the non-judicial. That's already happened? The foreclosure has taken place already?
Right, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they can still file papers within what we're doing, and we can put it into the case, again, the place where we're using as a depository, which will be a lot of our evidence for this particular case that we'll be filing new. And we'll bring it to light. Matter of fact, I know last week we were talking, we're looking at filing. Well, I think I know we want to get back to filing non-judicial foreclosures. I don't know that we really stopped, but I've become too busy to really get involved with it. I know Jim's been trying to get a hold of me, and so I think he's got a few laying around that needs to get filed. But again, whether your home has been foreclosed on already or if it's being foreclosed, and especially if it's been foreclosed, we'll definitely file some paperwork. With an affidavit that you might do to put it into the court for something that needs to be heard. Because, again, this is the evidence of what we're trying to bring together. The point we're trying to make is that the people cannot get justice in their courts. But if you have the ability to file a federal case, then you need to move it to federal court for cause. And that's what you need to do. And you could do that on your own. But again, you could still file the paperwork with us and see where it goes with that. But you have to be able to really follow their procedures. And again, you have to be careful of the Rule 12 trap and maybe read some of the paperwork we're going to be putting together shortly out there for this filing against the judiciary. And whereas how we're going to deal with Rule 12 and also bring the point up that we've structured our paperwork according to the requirements of Rule 8. And I think we pretty close came to a lot of that positioning on the paperwork we filed when they tried to throw us out on the gun case for Rule 12. And that's why they're not answering, because they're kind of stuck. And maybe that's a heads up to us. That they're concerned that we're going to be filing an appeal should they go to the wrong direction, and they don't really have a place to hang their hat on their decision. Additionally, there is another case I'm involved with, personal, that's in the federal court, and it's going to the appellate court. This is the first one I've ever filed on the appellate court system. So the procedure was a little different. It really was the paperwork and the way the instructions they give you, the rules and everything, seem very confusing, but you really have to sit down and dissect all of their rulemaking that they've made and the paperwork that they give to the pro se's for filing an appellate case. Again, now that I've done one, and I've kind of see where, how this works, maybe I'll be able to write something up to make it a lot easier for people, because I think if they made a chart, and they don't want to make it easy for us, but really we should make a chart on filing court cases, whether it be on the state level or whether it be on the federal level, and then the appellate process. We can't really do much on the state level on the appellate process, but on the federal level we could. We have a little experience on the state level in New York, but each state, I think, is different. And of course, the federal level is different, too. Here in New York, we have 9 months to perfect the case. The only thing we have to do is serve the notice of appeal and serve it on to file it with the courts and serve it on to all the parties. I don't even recall if we paid a fee here in New York for that. Gerard, do you remember if we paid a fee when we filed that appellate case here in New York a while back? I don't recall paying a fee. But the federal level, they charge you $505 to file of an appeal in the federal level. They want $500 that you have to send to the district where the case comes from, where it generated from, and an additional $5 fee, and then you have to file the paperwork in these forms that they have. You have to file, once you do that filing on the court of origin, then they give you 14 days to make your notice of appearance. I know that they've got a special notice of appearances for all of the defendants coming in. or the other side, maybe it's the plaintiffs that were filing the maybe it's the defendant that's filing the appeal. I don't know, but in our case, of course, it was the plaintiff. They charged quite a bit of money. So in a federal court alone, it's $400 to move it into the. Well, you can move your case for free into the federal court if you have an existing court, a case on the state level. But if you did have to file, it's $400 to file a federal case, and another $505 to file your appeal if you're going to do an appeal. And maybe on the appellate court is where we'll get justice. Maybe on the appellate court where they'll have a conscience. Maybe on the appellate court is where they do understand more of what's really going on as far as the destruction of the deep state, and maybe get a little fear of the people and decide, well, maybe we're going to start doing the right thing. Of course, our case is going to be a huge case because we're going to be covering such a magnitude of things. But particularly, of course, looking, the key point is getting open a court of justice and making sure that there is a process to get there without having to pay money. Because once you pay the money, you're now moved into a statutory process. You see, they can charge the fees on the statutory level. And that's how they're getting away with this on the federal level. And also Rule 18, which we discussed before. And again, anybody who doesn't believe me on this really needs to go take a look on 18, USC 18, Title 18, and look to see the jurisdiction. It's maritime, okay? And everything and anything they use against the people, we the people, it seems always come out of 18. And if I know when we filed the case in the Southern District, okay, again, it was an IRS case, and we filed down there, we put down on the paperwork directly that this was a constitutional issue. And and we named a few different amendments, of course, particularly due process. And... But in any event, when we filed the case down there, the court clerk was very nice, came out, talked, and gave us a lot of information, okay, but said that, look, you really need to find a statute to lead this case out with. So he said on that line, maybe use something like U.S. 42, and I told him we already used that, but I said, okay, we'll put it up front. You know, we're kind of following the Bill Thornton idea on this one. But I realize now we should have resisted that, and we're going to resist that next time. We will not file this case using any U.S. codes or titles. We will file it only for, constitutional issues. But we will make points for U.S. 42, U.S. 18, for criminal and for civil procedures also, because we can make notes of those particular codes in our case, which gives a guideline to, which is policies and procedures for them on how they need to behave. And not, assault the people out on the highways is kind of the way it puts it. But we need to make the case that we do know that because we're quoting those points, that applies to them. That particular title does not affect us, and we're not controlled or governed in any way, shape, or form by that title. So I think we got to make that point clearer. again, for those who don't really understand some of the things I'm talking about, maybe you haven't been following along, this is where it's key to read the papers. And if you haven't been reading the papers, you need to go back to read the latest papers. You need to read all the papers that we filed in the federal court in the Northern District, particularly as a depository, a place to store all of our paperwork and to place into position under the auspices of the court all of our indictments. That case is very important to take a look at to see how we put that together, but also to look at our New York case where they're stalling right now. And then the paperwork we're going to file now, and then if we file a response, and the response that we filed in our gun case here in the Northern District, The response that we filed on to the court against the, you know, they're in opposition to the bringing the Rule 12, you know, applying that upon us. But now I think we're going to be kind of couching ourselves a little bit concerning that kind of a response by them in this next case. But again, filing this in the Northern District, the sooner the better, because it's kind of a double whammy. It puts more pressure on them. They see us, oh, they're coming up again. And this time, we're not going against New York State. We're going against the, you know, the court, the federal judiciary. But again, you know, this is all brand new territory for all of us. I don't know that anybody has ever done anything like we've done. But it bears and holds up to logic. It works within, you know, the common law process as far as we the people taking responsibility and taking control and taking back our, back our courts and taking back our nation. So I think there's a lot we can rest upon. But again, nobody has done what we're doing, at least not that I'm aware of. All right. What else we got, Jan?
Okay. Next, can you explain where in the body of the Constitution it says we the people are not to be taxed directly upon our income, while describing the terms apportioned and unapportioned and any difference between the two if applicable?
Yeah, well, you know, Brent covered this. I don't know if it was last week or the week before. He was talking about the direct tax. I think it was 2 weeks ago. He was talking a little bit about the direct tax, and that was found in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4. Although it is used in another place, it's in Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3. But in Clause, going to Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4, it says no captation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. And then it goes into the census and so on. So I think the proportion, you know, the proportions among the states, and maybe maybe once I make a point or two, maybe Brent might want to jump in and add on this, but I think what they're talking about on the proportions there is basically the tax going to be applied directly to the states, not to the people. And it isn't percentage-wise according to the people within the states, in other words, their representation, and there would be a percentage breakdown, sort of course, like how many representatives they have in Congress and how they do that calculation, which they don't really use anymore because the population has grown so great. And I think something needs to be amended on that. But, of course, we don't want to even talk to them about doing anything like that right now. But a direct tax is a tax that is not directly laid upon you directly, but it's laid upon you indirectly. Like when you go to the store to buy something and you pay a tax that's attached to the product, it's not directly upon you. Of course, that is passed on to the purchaser, and they end up paying the tax. And so that kind of a tax would have to be, again, done through the states. And I would imagine the fact that everyone would be responsible to pay to some percentage a piece, which ultimately comes through the states, I think the states really would have to put a special tax out to be able to accomplish the amounts, I would imagine, in order to pay their portion. But maybe, of course, it could be the case. Well, I'm not sure. Can you add on to that, Brent, and kind of clean the rest of that up? Because I'm not too sure how to understand that, the rest of the part on how they would do that.
John, did you reference me?
Yep.
Wait if it's all right. And
I was just wondering on the direct tax, if you wanted to talk a little bit more to add on to that direct tax that we find in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4, and how they might go about collecting that. So in other words, we know that it has to do, the captation or the direct tax has to be laid in proportion. Okay, to the census of enumeration, Okay, we see that that's the language of Article 1, Section 9. We also see that in Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, it talks about the representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included within this union, and it goes on. But so it gives a little more information. But what it seems to be is the direct tax is laid upon the population, but through the states in proportion to the representation or the way that they figure out the census. Maybe you can expound and take it from there, because to me it's not too clear exactly how that works.
No, it is not clear, and I've been pounding my head against this stuff for 20 years, and I've listened to people that claim they've got the answers, and they go through in detail the tax code, and now I've listened to Larry Beecraft. Talk to Larry. Larry Beecraft probably knows more about the successive tax codes that have been passed, 1954, 1980, whatever, when Reagan, the new one was put in place. And he has done a great job of understanding the tax code. But from my perspective, having just looked at it from the earliest days onward, the last 80, 90 years, or however long it's been, well, it's been longer than that, now it's been over 100 years since 1913. Mike, and before that, going back at before the war between the southern and northern tiers of the states, this question about proportion of taxes has never been practically hammered out. But it seems clear to me that the Constitution says that, as you had said, a natural conclusion you draw. You drew the conclusion that every state is responsible once the tax is laid directly. It's the state's responsibility to produce that amount of money in proportion to their population in relationship to the rest of the states. That's fundamentally, I believe, what the Constitution's saying. But it's never been really put to the hard test as to how that would play out. Another thing I noticed about taxes is that the Constitution says this crystal clear, but it hasn't been done, that Congress is to be responsible for the collection of taxes. It doesn't say that the president's responsible. Well, if the IRS is the tax collector, that means the president is responsible, because that's the executive department. All the bureaucracies are under him. But if congressmen were truly to collect taxes, it would really put a positive effect on our country, because as soon as a congressman started abusing people, or Congress started abusing people in the collection of taxes, they wouldn't stay in office very long, because people would directly see that, hey, this is Congress's job to collect taxes, and they're abusing people. Well, right now, the IRS is collecting taxes and abusing people. I've seen people commit suicide over the baloney they pulled on. By exaggerating, it's worse than that sometimes. How could it be worse than death? Well, it destroys families, destroys relationships, destroys the country. And when you want to change that, you go to Congress, and Congress says, hey, it wasn't us, it was the IRS guys. We just passed the laws. And, of course, the IRS guys, and I've heard them say it, they'll say, hey, it's not us. It's Congress that says we're supposed to do these things. And they keep passing it around. The president acts like he didn't have anything to do with any of it, when the truth of the matter is he's responsible for all of it, as long as the IRS is collecting taxes. So to sum up, 2 points I'd make is, we haven't hammered this out, but the observation that you make, John, I think is correct about what the Constitution and common sense says, and when we read it, that the taxes, if they're direct, that means you can't pass them off to somebody else, like a sales tax. And if they're direct on you, then those kind of taxes are apportioned according to the population of the states. For example, Wyoming doesn't have a million people living there. California has upwards of 40, 50 million people. So in proportion, if a tax is laid that is direct on people and they can't pass along, then the state of California and the state of Wyoming are to make sure that those taxes are collected and delivered to the federal government. However they do it, the federal government shouldn't care, as long as they get their money that they've taxed. And they're to do it according to the proportion of the population of the states. Well, if the state only has a million people, or a million and a half, for example, like Idaho or Montana, however, they've got probably a million. And, Alaska has less than a million, as does Wyoming. Well, certainly they would pay less according to their population than California. New York, Illinois has 12, 13 million people. Texas, 30 million people. I'm guessing. I don't know exactly, but it's something like that. Well, in proportion, that would be different. We're not doing that. And the question, ultimate question that we deal with today is income tax and direct tax? Well, the Supreme Court of the United States said it was until about the time that the income tax amendment was added in 1913. And all of a sudden, then the court changed its tune and says, no. The income tax is not direct, but it doesn't have to be apportioned among the states, and the IRS to come and individually hammer one person to death or send them to jail or whatever they want to do, instead of saying no, that federal government has to go to the states. That's what the Constitution says. See, if we followed that simple principle, then all of this abuse of the IRS would go away, and it would put the states back in the saddle, and they would have a say as to how this is done, and they would be more responsive, of course, to the needs of the people that would otherwise be abused by the IRS. That's the answer. The Constitution of the United States lays this tax scheme out of the federal government. Very good. Now, the courts have said that the taxing powers of the federal government have always been plenary. There's not much they can't do when it comes to the amount of taxes they lay, but the Constitution is very specific about how, H-O-W, they go about doing that, and that's what is not being observed now. In other words, due process. The process that the Constitution of the United States says is due according, pertaining to taxation. That's what's not being followed, and that's why there is the oppression that people complain about. Back to you, John.
Okay, thank you, Brent. And again, you know, I know that early on, and I was looking as you were talking to see if I could find some of these rulings. Maybe I'll find them in a short when I can get a chance to breeze through a few of my files here. But early on, back in the earlier part of the 20th century, the Supreme Court did rule get it right as far as the 16th Amendment was concerned, saying that it really added nothing new to the process. It just put it back to where it belongs, talking particularly about direct tax. You know, direct tax can be laid upon corporations and other commercial activities, but it cannot be laid upon the people. There cannot be no direct tax there. And again, you know, I got to believe that also a direct tax being a violation, a constitutional violation, even if the state were to try to apply the state tax on the head, I think they'd have a problem. They have to work out the proportion, as we're discussing, and then they would have to then figure out, well, how are they going to get this tax, how are they going to collect this tax, and I guess it'd be up to them on how they're going to work that out collectively. You know, you can't take money away from an individual that doesn't have it. So that's clear, and you can't tax one person higher than another person. That's kind of clear too. So they have to figure a way to do this, and maybe enter it into their sales tax or whatever creativity they may want to get into on that. But putting it upon us directly would be a problem, I think, a constitutional problem. Again, no direct tax, and that would work as much on the state level as it would be on the federal level. But again, as far as the Supreme Court rulings in the very early on concerning the movement of the 16th Amendment, where they tried to get away with collecting a quote-unquote income tax, the Supreme Court definitely made good rulings for us. And maybe as time went on, maybe they made some bad rulings I'm not aware of. But we've used some of these good rulings. But they seem to ignore it because, again, they hold up the status quo. I think they feel comfortable because people haven't figured out that maze to get through, to say the right words, to be in the right place and position yourself. I remember there was a few things we said in court on an IRS case a while back, which ended us up with us getting a release of lien and also a letter of apology and a few other things. And there's two or three things that took place in that case that makes me wonder on which one of those two or three things had really stuck into that, into the mind of that judge that he made the decision the way he did, or shall I say, didn't make the decision, and the way things worked out in that case. And I don't feel there are three different items, and maybe one day we'll discuss those three items, but I want to think about that a little more to see which one I put more weight upon and then how we're going to address it in this next case that we got coming up that's in the same thing. But clearly, there's numerous things about the IRS, and we're going to cover those things in our court case, I think. I'm not too sure exactly how, but I think we're going to cover some of this in the court case. But again, they don't have the power or the authority for a direct tax. Early on, the Supreme Court agreed with that decision that they don't have the power or the authority, and that the 16th Amendment added nothing new. Also, the fact that it was never, what's the word I'm looking for, Jan? We just did three papers on this. I passed them over to you, as a matter of fact. Okay, they never...
No.
Jan, are you with me on this?
Yes, I have the same block you got.
Yeah, I did the paper. We did the paper on the 13th. Matter of fact, we'll post them up. Maybe tomorrow I'll get a time to post this up.
They never really ratified it.
Ratified.
Thank you very much. Okay. And they didn't ratify the 13th Amendment. They didn't ratify the... I don't know about the 14th. I didn't see anything that they didn't ratify, but the language in the 14th is problematic to a lot of the codes that they had already written after to, you know, kind of work their way around feeling comfortable to say, well, we're just following statutes, you know. So the 14th Amendment was a different case, and we could make a position that civil really identifies with just the fact that we're citizens. I know, you know, that Brent kind of holds that position. I was kind of holding more the position of the meaning of the word civil, which really works us into statutes. But again, you know, maybe it's the other way around, too. But they love to play games with words, and, of course, that's confusing, and that's why we have to be very careful that we, you know, in certain words that we may use in battling a case like this, that we want to define what we mean by these words, how we're understanding them. The 16th Amendment was not ratified. That's, of course, the income tax one. The 17th Amendment was not ratified. That, of course, was the one that they took away our senators. And I mentioned the 13th Amendment was never ratified. Let me go back with that. The 13th Amendment disappeared. The original 13th Amendment disappeared. And they put the slavery in there on the 13th, which should be the 14th, which wasn't a necessity to begin with. I think they just had to fill a void. I don't know. But there was no real need for them to write a 13th Amendment the way they did. But I don't see really much of a need for them to have written anything after the first 10 amendments anyway. Maybe there's a few things they could have changed that they did, and that's fine. You know, I'm not too happy the way they changed the electing of the president. They made it a party thing. I think in the beginning... they had it where you would elect the president, and the second, whoever came in second, became the vice president. And they changed that, of course. And one of the biggest problems, and we do talk about this in the paper with the 17th Amendment, even though it hasn't been ratified, but also the fact of the matter is it's in contradiction to the balance of powers, okay, that it takes away their vote. You can't. The Senate or the states cannot lose their vote, and that's in Article 5, I believe, of the Constitution, where it says, "No state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage." The word suffrage means vote. Their equal vote in the Senate. So no state shall be deprived of that. If you deprive a state of their equal vote in the Senate, then if you're able to deprive that state of that, that state is no longer sovereign as far as a state can be sovereign. They become enslaved to the federal government, where they have no say, no response, no recourse to anything that the federal legislators do, and anything that the president might do, and so on. I mean, these are state issues. When right now what's going on in the Senate should be directly state issues. They shouldn't be senators who are elected by people. This is not a congressman's issue. Although we have an extra congressman, so to speak, each state has two extra positions. It doesn't even make sense. But again, it broke the balance of power. It made a great injury. And even though they changed the necessary language in Article 1 concerning the choosing of the senators, they forgot all about Article 5, and they never corrected that. And maybe they ignored it because they figured maybe people won't pay attention. I don't know. And because if you think about it and they bring it to the surface, maybe, you know, the person will have that Helen Keller moment and say, whoa, wait a second. You're taking away any power and authority from the state to have a say concerning its federal government. And wait a second, the federal government, isn't that supposed to be the collection of the states, ultimately? Isn't the power and the authority for the states in the legislation? Isn't the power and authority in the states, states legislators in the Senate also by the decision of whatever the president makes on who he appoints to become a justice, a Supreme Court justice, or putting them into the federal district? Isn't that the decision of the Senate? Isn't that the decision of the states, not of the people? Okay, and these are important issues. Our founding fathers spent a lot of time working this out, framing this out, and in just one little stroke, which isn't even lawful by the 17th Amendment, they turned the whole balance of power up on its head and upside down. They've destroyed the balance of power. You know, I'm listening to Trump very carefully. I'm listening to Pompeo. I'm listening to even John Bolton. I heard him talk a little today, and others, and they keep pounding away, we must return the rule of law. And when certain questions are asked, especially anyone that's listening in to paying attention to what's going on with Q, you know, it gets back to the rule of law must be applied. There, you can't have the rule of law here and say, well, we're not going to have the rule of law there. Either the Constitution gets enforced or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, then that's war. War against the people, and we have the ultimate right to pick up arms against such a resistance of a government. But that's not the problem we're having with our government at this point in time, that we need to bring it to that extreme. And I think a lot of these problems are in the process of being fixed. We need to reinforce them. And I heard, I don't know if anybody heard the president's address to the UN. And Bolton was there, and Secretary Pompeo was there, and who was the other one? Nikki Haley, I think it is. There was three of them. If you haven't seen this, you need to go find this on YouTube. I listened very carefully to the address made by this woman who's an ambassador to the UN along with John Bolton, Nikki Haley. And what a class act, the way she addressed the UN, the way this whole process was addressed to them. It became clear that this president has taken control of the UN and is moving this UN as a leader should be, as the United States, as the prime leadership of the UN should be, to bring it together as partners to battle things that is necessary for the countries to come together and battle, like this quote-unquote war on drugs. The security committee came together. I think there was from 32 countries. I think it was the entire security committee is working together on a literal war on drugs to stop drug production or movement through their countries, and working together, passing information back and forth to go after these people and to destroy all of this poisoning that's putting in, you know, on our people and we the people, not only in the United States but around the world. And but if you listen after they had a goodness, it must have been a 20-25 minute news conference where John Bolton spoke and Pompeo and Haley, but mostly Pompeo really did most of the speaking, and it became crystal clear, at least from my watching and listening to what was being said and what took place, that this president. And he's not alone. Remember, this president cannot do what he's doing alone. He's got a huge amount of people behind him, a huge amount of people who understand the problem, a huge amount of people in government that is working to take this deep state out and to bring them to justice and to judgment. And again, they have to have a court of justice to bring them to. And it is true that they could do military tribunals, but in a lot of these cases, they got to bring them into courts of justice. You know, in cases that are not necessarily treason. Only the treasonal ones can be taken out of the nation, maybe take them out to Cuba there or do something with the military tribunals. But as far as anything other than treason, then people have to be tried in courts of justice. And so that has to be reestablished, because right now, if they're going to follow the rule of law everywhere, they got to follow the rule of law in our courts. And clearly the rule of law in our courts is not there. And you can't convict these people. Well, actually, you can. You can convict these people on U.S. 18, U.S.C. codes, or Title 18, because they are either elected, appointed, or directly just engaged as an employee by the government, which brings them under U.S.C. 18, Title 18, okay? We, the people, cannot be held underneath that. Also, I can't think of one case. Let me think of this. With the exception of maybe treason, I can't think of one case where they have any power or authority over the people to rule, to bring people into a federal court to charge them with anything, really. Only people who are employed or into a commercial process that's covered under one of the 54 titles. Of course, those are not criminal courts, and I hate to use the word criminal court because really, it's really just a court of justice is what it is. If it's a criminal court, it's a court of justice. But you can use these codes against these people who work for the government. That's what they were written for, to keep them under control, to make it clear in their minds and understanding that don't cross this line, don't break this law. And so it's sort of policies and procedures or statutes, shall we say, for them, and it can be applied, but not to us, you know. So when we move a case into the federal court for cause, we're looking now to deal with a constitutional issue. We're not really looking to deal with any kind of a U.S. code, a title issue. So we would be going into a court of justice, which means we shouldn't have to pay for anything. And we certainly shouldn't have to pay either for an appellate court, because courts of justice charges no money. We will sell to no man. And so we got a lot of straightening up to do. But and it may sound complex. I know as I'm looking at different things, you know, one thing I've learned by God's mercy some years ago is that all complex things are made up just of a lot of simple things. You break it down to its simplest forms, and you'll understand, oh, yeah, that's simple, that's simple, that's simple, that's simple. 20 simple things make something complex. It's the construction of many little things to make the big thing that appears to be complex. It's like filing, and I want to tell you, I racked my brain for a couple of days on this. And after I got through this, I wondered and said to myself, I should have understood this a lot earlier on, but it's just that they threw so many rules at you to try to find out the process of how to go into an appellate court. And then, of course, there's the question of do we belong in an appellate court? And in this case, we don't have a choice. We have to go into appellate court. But also, we need to go into the appellate courts with the position that we're in there tell these people to talk to their lower people in their court and fix the problem. We're not in there to ask them to make any kind of a decision for us, to overrule a judge in the sense that we're, you know, coming to them, asking them for that kind of a situation. No, we're there telling them that there is a problem of justice, that justice is not being applied in the courts, that judges are ruling under the status quo, and that people are being injured, rejected, thrown out, particularly through this Rule 12, which no one seems to be able to define. But the United States Supreme Court in a ruling did define it, and I also figured and realized out that also Rule 8 defines it. If you want to know and understand to make sure that you've made a good case and that you've given a good cause of, how do they put it, a cause of, I don't think they called it a cause of action, but that you're making a case that could be brought into the courts that makes sense and is covering, you know, all the necessary points, read Rule 8. Rule 8 is pretty simple, cut and dry. I also would like to just make the comment, since we're talking about rules, because we've been talking a little bit about rules over the months, and I thought I'd be finding a lot of rules that would be problematic. And the only rules that I'm really finding that might be problematic are the local rules, although some of them make common sense, too. And there, again, is a lot of abuse done on the local level, okay? As far as finding a problem with the rules, again, I only find a problem with Rule 12. And Rule 12 is only a problem when you have unjust judges who refuse to give up their power and authority when they have none and allow the courts of justice to move forward without their interference. And that's the problem we have. And if we didn't have that problem, Rule 12 is a good idea, okay? Because, you know, it does cut nonsensical cases off right at the beginning. You know, it's not, it shouldn't be need to go forward. But again, you know, you have all these jurisdictions. Only 27 of them are actually lawful. The others are kind of policies and procedures out of the 54. All can be applied as such upon people working in government, and in the cases of law, those who are working in the commercial realms, whatever it is that's being discussed, you know, whatever the law is speaking about, then all of that is lawful. But even there, again, you know, this is a big task, and this is where the people who do go to law school, where they really should be working these things out, not working on how to interpret law and apply it, but working on how to, really learn law on how to really, how can I even say this? Let me think. People, when they go to law school, they're taught, this happens, you do that, you apply this, you apply that. For instance, we're told, you know, by the guy who taught us, Gerard, you know, if you're going to go into the court, find a statute. You don't need the Constitution. Well, we rejected that from day one, and we do use the Constitution. But that's a rejection. But that's what they teach lawyers, to work within the statutory process. Don't get into the interpretation of the meaning of what the Constitution means here or there. And that cripples all of us, because it brings every individual that has taken an oath to rely upon the interpretation of a bar-taught lawyer on the meaning of our Constitution that was written in plain language by and for the people. Ultimately it was. They stayed away from all of this strange language. I mean, the Constitution is pretty simple and clear. That captation one, you know, the direct tax, I think that's kind of clear. You know, I don't think it's all that, you know, difficult to see, you know, just that the states have the opportunity to figure out how they're going to collect it. But other than that, it's done proportionally to the states according to representation, according to the last census, and therefore applying towards the representation, which works towards the portions of each of the states. You know, this is an uphill battle, but fighting to keep courts of justice, we can't go to an appellate court seeking from the position of weakness as if they have anything to say over anything we do, because, first of all, we opened a court of record. And second, and more importantly, the only thing necessary to make a prima facie case in a court of justice is a sworn affidavit. And you can do that on a piece of toilet paper with a pencil if you wanted to. It's valid. It's as good as anything else. It's a sworn statement. Here's my complaint. Nothing else is required. Now, they will tell you different, and they will make use of the processes that they have on all these title jurisdictions and then move that and sweep it under U.S. 18, which is no law at all, okay, not to the people, and apply it. And that only happened back in 1939 or 1949. It's pretty darn recent, you know. It was a generation before a lot of us, and some of us that are here today, you know, their generation is in the 40s when this big turn or change made. But there was a lot of chaos going on in the country. You know, we just went through the Great Depression. And then we had World War II. And we had all these things going on. And there was so much distraction. And by the time you get out to the other end of things, they've really dumbed down the people and removed, taken control of education, taken control of the media. And, you know, information received, information comes out. Whatever it is that you program into that computer, so to speak, into that mind, that child, the people. So if a people, and we'll go back to this, this is really not difficult. It's a matter of spending time understanding each piece little by little, making the corrections necessary as we go along. But it gets back to what Jefferson said. If you expect to be ignorant and free at the same time, forget about it. Ain't going to happen. Just go home and be a good slave. Or step up and let's discover the tools and the necessary weapons that we, the people, need to take back our liberties, to take back our consent to government, whether it be through the political process, the committee men, or through the judicial process, which would be, of course, the jury and the grand jury and the trial juries. That's it. Gerard, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I wanted to just go over real quick that whole business of no new powers of taxation being entered by the 16th Amendment. And there was a good reason that they came to that conclusion. Because don't forget, everything they do through smoke and mirrors, and they and we're dumbed down, and we don't even look at that Title 26 of the tax code. They purposely made it massive so that you couldn't even find anything in it.
No entrance is given, and that's the same thing that the same language they use in US 18. Same language.
Well, here's what I've discovered in doing some research on what they're doing. Is first of all, the way the tax code is written, it is constitutional. It absolutely is. But you see, what they do is they expand it. And the Supreme Court has ruled three times that they cannot expand the statute with a regulation. And that's exactly what they do to trick the people. And so if you're dumb enough to go in there and live by that regulation that doesn't apply to you, then they have a right to hold you to it. So what everybody doesn't understand is that in the beginning of the tax code is subsection 83, which says that gross income is predicated on a W-4, which is minus expenses. This is an important point. Minus expenses means that your labor, you're supposed to get fair market value, which cancels that whole income out. It says proceeds above expenses, which means you're making money on stocks, bonds, or these other things, interest, but not on the labor from your hands is chargeable and write-offable. It's a deduction that they're not giving you. When you take your W-2 and the W-4 that the employer puts in and they put gross income, they completely left out subsection 83, which says that you're entitled to a fair market value of your labor, which actually cancels out all your income. You have no taxable income at that point. Unless you're taking your income and you're putting it in stocks and bonds and these other things that they have a right to tax, you have no taxable income. And so, therefore, they have no right to tax you on it. And they're playing games. And they've written the statute that when they got done with that tax code, they said, look it, this doesn't apply to United States citizens. So they said, well, what are we going to do? So they said, okay, let's put a regulation in that makes it sound like it does. They hit it in another section in the tax code that says any, all income, all this other baloney, but it far exceeds the actual statute. And when it was taken to court, it's been beaten three times already. The Supreme Court said, no, that doesn't apply because it's going beyond what the statute says. And they said, the IRS or the agency that's interpreting the law and writing us the regulations has no right to consider that, well, Congress intended to mean this, so we'll write it into a regulation. That's what they're doing. So you're really not liable for any income you're producing with the sweat of your brow under fair market value. It's already deductible, but they're not deducting it because included in your gross income is your labor, and you're entitled to a fair market. Look at who said that they could steal my labor? They can't do it. It's unconscionable. So they're not giving you the price of your labor. Look, you contracted with your employer to give him this much time for so much an hour. That's an expense that they need to take off the top of your tax bill. If you got other income that's coming in from other stuff like stocks and bonds and real estate that you're earning interest on, and maybe even capital gains on property or something that is not the sweat of your brow, they have a right to tax it. But,
well, again, and that's trying to define their language using their code, their information, their language, and tracing that through. And they give, for instance, they'll give us, you know, the meaning of a certain word. For instance, a person is a corporation. In U.S. 26, they hide that, of course. They're under, I don't know, over 7,000, 8,000 pages of stuff. That, I mean, just gobbledygook, nonsensical stuff that makes absolutely no sense at all. Nothing. Anybody who reads the paperwork that the IRS gives you, take your time to dissect that paper. Take your time to look up every single one of those codes, and then look up the meaning of words. You know, what is a corporation? You know, what is this? What is that? And then you, and you can do that pretty easy because you got a search engine. You throw the U.S. code in there, and you just do a control find and pop it everywhere it's at. But you see, therein is another problem that they had that they never fixed. Because if you want to interpret their words using it against them, if the people are a corporation, anything that's an overhead to that corporation is a write-off. So the fact that I got to eat is a write-off. The fact that I have to live is a write-off. The fact that I have to entertain this particular corporation in order to keep it healthy is a write-off. I mean, there's practically nothing you can't do that isn't a write-off. And even the fact that you put money in the bank to save or whatever the case may be or to invest is for your future, for you know, being able to survive in the times when you're not working and so on. Again, more write-offs. So it doesn't even work even when you apply their own words, their own language, and utilize, you know, what is a write-off and what can you use it for and how do corporations get those things. But again, the easiest way to deal with this is to file it under one file. Name that file fraud. And everything else therein is just the construction of that fraud. And let's get back to the simplicity of bringing us back into courts of justice, and that's our battle. And it doesn't get any more difficult than that. And everything we think and doing concerning this particular case coming up and everything ultimately building up to this point has always been around that one word alone, it's the word justice. And no human court, no court of human law can give you justice. Those can control corporations, commercial activities, processes, and control lots of different things in the U.S. codes that we've given them the authority to write under Article 1, particularly in Section 8. But also, you know, even though we give them that authority, they have no authority to write natural law, for natural law has already been written, and it's written in the hearts of all men, ultimately. We all know right from wrong. Very few people whose consciences are seared, and even those serial killers, they know right. They know they're doing wrong. They just don't have any feelings concerning about it one way or another. They have no compassion, no empathy, okay? But ultimately, everyone knows they're doing wrong. Even a child, a little child, when they do wrong, you know, as they start to figure things out, you know, they know when they're doing wrong. They can figure it out pretty quick. And they start looking for maybe some justice heading their way. But, you know, as a child. But in any event, this is our battle. This is our argument. This is our position. It gets right back to one thing, courts of justice versus the courts of ultimately courts of men. We're not to be judged under the courts of men. Now, of course, we have contracts. We can go into the equity courts where a judge will make a decision. Courts can move a lot quicker through that process as long as we have just men working them and applying the contract agreement that we have between two individuals that have this argument that they bring into a court. And it is, of course, there's an appellate system for that, so that all works out fine. And generally, any case that I have become aware of, any case that I've been involved with, anything in construction when years ago, over the years, you know, I knew construction law, and most of it was in arbitration under architects or engineers, being the judges for that, or you can go into a different kind of an arbitrational system, or bring it into the courts. And it still becomes an arbitrational thing if you're into the court of equity and you're using a judge to deal with it. But all the time, any case I've looked at, any argument and position that I made on behalf of a contractor or myself has always been the knowledge of where right and wrong was, where I could win and where I would lose, because it was logical, it was obvious, and you can defend it, and it cannot be defeated, okay? And some things you can win on and some things you lose. So you give a little, you take a little, you negotiate, and you get out. It's called arbitration ultimately. Okay, and I think that's what you would call a court of equity to some degree, arbitrational courts. And but they need to be just courts under American jurisprudence. And, of course, anything that gets into a charge against we the people must go directly into a court of justice. Anything over $20, we have the right to call for a court of justice. Anything that violates one of our unalienable rights, we have a right to go right into a court of justice. We don't need to be dealing with their statutory processes. And that, of course, is our battle. That is, it doesn't get any more difficult than that. Everything else works off of that. It's that simple. All right. I think we beat this one to death. What else we got? I don't even know where we started on that one.
Yes. This one is easier and shorter.
Thank you.
Why are the words de facto and de jure both in Black's Law Dictionary, but neither word is in Webster's 1828 nor Bouvier's Law Dictionary?
Yeah, I don't know why it wouldn't be in the others, but of course it was put there because there is a difference between the two. You know, one is de facto, you know, one is de jure, and it's recognized in the courts, and you can use that recognition of the meaning of those words. And, you know, most of these courts are de facto courts. They're operating as if they have authority, and they do not have it. You know what? Doing this study that I had done on the U.S. titles, and again, you know, I'll post it soon. It'll be inside of our case, of course. It becomes so clear. Look at, if they apply something upon you, USC whatever, usually it's 18, go see what the jurisdiction is. Run the word jurisdiction, do a word search, and pop, 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 you'll see jurisdiction, and you'll find out where the jurisdiction is. US 18 is maritime law, period, end of subject. Okay? And they've only been getting away with this since 1949. So, you know, this hasn't been around a long, long time. Well, it's got to be 70 years, though. But nevertheless, you know, it's you can see it very clearly. You know, it has become clear to me, and again, we started off a little earlier with this. I forget how we got into it, that Trump, you know, has really is moving the United Nations into a very positive way as partners dealing with situations internationally, but not to affect each one of our sovereignties as far as we, the people of the United States, and the sovereignty of the people of other nations, however they work out their government, okay? He is really pushing it and seems to have taken control. You know, again, if you haven't seen this, you got to go look for it on YouTube and see his address. Nikki, what was her last name?
Haley.
Nikki Haley. What a great job she did introducing the President of the United States. I mean, and if you listen as they're talking and what's going on, when the President's talking, you're seeing smiles coming across the faces of all the people on that board, you know? You got Bolton back there, you got Pompey back there, you got numerous other people you'll recognize, and it's like giving it to the deep state, you know, giving it to the powers that were, ramming it up them, saying, hey, this is what you did with it. We're going to take it, and we're going to make it good. I tell you, I was impressed. I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. And then, of course, the interview after, the press conference after, you have to go listen to that. The other thing, of course, is to see what he's doing with the Federal Reserve. You know, he's appointed his own people. He has appointed puppets over there. And he's taking control of the Federal Reserve. Anybody watching and seeing what's going on over there, it's just amazing. I mean, it's like, who would ever dream that it could even happen the way it's happening? I mean, I thought we were going to have to go to war to win this back. Who would ever think? You know, I do know one thing, you know. The Ron Paul movement was a good movement. It was a big movement. It was a constitutional focus particularly. But Ron Paul could never have accomplished what it took a Donald Trump to do. He's very unique. I don't know if there's another person on the planet who has been groomed in such a way, so to speak, to take this position and be able to have the knowledge, the ability, the power, the authority, the guts, and the belief in themselves to go forward and do what has to be done, and to lead all the people behind him that assisted him to put him into that powerful position that we, the people, so desperately needed, you know, a type of Osiris, if I may, you know, that Trump is. So amazing, amazing things. We are in the right place at the right time. This is the right timing, even though, you know, it's taken a while to put this paper together because it has to be well-constructed. It has to be consistent and fluent. It has to be digestible from beginning to end. It's got to make sense as a whole. And we have to give a nice synopsis of what we're talking about to lead into what our case is all about. And we're looking 70, 80, 90, 100, maybe 150. I don't know how many pages. Lots of pages, lots of papers. And it is true that a lot of this stuff we've kind of already written. But to sew it together and to bring up new issues that we haven't developed or touched on before, to understand the law. You know, we did a study on the law a while back, all of the different courts, shall I say, all of the different courts that is mentioned inside of, we use Black's Law, fourth edition, I mean. And I think it was the fourth edition, wasn't it? Pretty sure it was the fourth edition. Yeah, it was the fourth. So we used that, and we came up with 50, 51, something like that, different courts. And so each court has its own jurisdiction. And when you read through this stuff, you have to kind of realize, and again, it's not complex, okay, but everything has to be put back in its proper perspective of where it belongs, what kind of law are we talking about. And most of this stuff is statutory law. It has not much to do with courts of justice, which really operates out of the hearts and the minds of the people themselves, period. It's laws of nature and of nature's God, the application of right and wrong, of what's right and what's wrong. And so, you know, once you kind of look at that from that perspective, then you look how Article 1 of the Constitution, Section 8, empowered Congress to do their law writing and apply in each one of these titles somewhere in Article 8, which we've done in this study that we're putting together now. It's all pulled together, you know, what is the authority for each one of these different titles, okay, and then what's left over. But once you look at it from that perspective, almost all of this stuff really has nothing to do with anything that we the people are doing. It has to do with what they are doing, and to control them with these statutes, policies and procedures, if I may say, with penalty, okay? They've already contracted in to that administrative process and accept the punishments applied within the legislature concerning whatever it is that they violate, okay, under those statutes. Again... it's very well structured. It's all in place. It just needs to be expressed and explained in a fluent way, bringing it all together to make it clear. But if people think they're going to be lazy and they're not going to study and not going to learn these things, then you're not doing the movement any good. You're not really helping. We're going to win this process through knowledge. Okay? Knowledge is the power and the authority of the people. And without it, there is nothing. The knowledge of the Constitution is the power and the authority of the sheriff. If only the sheriff can understand and realize the power and the authority that they have. But they're afraid to interpret it. They don't know what the meaning of this is or the meaning of that. It's ridiculous. It means what it says. There's no interpret. There's nothing, no big mystery here. It's plain language for plain people, as Jefferson said. And this is what our founding fathers put together. Very plain language for very plain people. Of course, there's the mechanisms and structures of the government that's described in Article 1, 2, and 3, and throughout the whole Constitution, of course. Very minimum, not much, but nevertheless it's there. And some of those words, like suffrage, when I first looked at that word, I didn't know what suffrage meant. You know, I'd scratch my head on it, and I said, well, dummy, maybe why don't you just look it up, you know, see what it says in a regular dictionary first, see what it says in Black, see what it says in Bouvier's, and understand what the meaning of that word is. Oh, it means a vote? Well, that was pretty simple. Why didn't they just say vote? I don't know why, but those are the words they use, and it's not that much of it, okay? There is no, it's very clear, once you understand the meaning of the words that's being used in the sentences and the paragraphs and the clauses and so on, it's just the meaning of applying the meaning of words. There's no legalese in there. There's no, you go to rule this, rule that, section 1, section B, except for it doesn't violate section D of this U.S. code over here, which maybe has to be interpreted there and understand the meaning of this word over there. I mean, that's what they do. That's what the IRS does. I trace all their codes out. You trace them from code to code to code, and it's like finding the it's like writing codes. It's code writers. Well, that's what they are, I guess, code writers, huh? And you say, whoa, that's what it means. You string the meaning across these numbers and letters that they use to come to the meaning and understanding of a word, a sentence, or a phrase. And again, it's kind of interesting, but. We don't have to deal with much of that, okay, because it doesn't apply to the people. If you're going to get involved in some commercial activity, well, you need to find out what the rules of the game is for the commercial activity, if it's interstate, what's going on, so on and so on and so on. And if something is there that seems to be unconstitutional, something that's wrong, that seems to be repugnant, then you need to pick at it and figure out what it is and bring it up and battle it and fight it. And it's a battle we all have to fight. But again, the simple one is the court of justice, the court of the hearts, the court where God sits as king, and we judge right and wrong and what that penalty might be to restore that individual that was injured. And in some cases, you know, again, you know, if it's a felony and it's a, what do they call it, an infamous crime, And I perceive an infamous crime, from what I understand, is a crime that requires that is given with a jail sentence. Okay, that's what I think an infamous crime means. Hey, have you ever looked into that meaning there, Brent? The infamous crime. Maybe Brent's away. All right, we'll get him on it later. But anyway, this is a simple little book called The Constitution. Fits in your top pocket. Thin. Read it. Get out your Black's Law. Get out a regular dictionary. I see you're unmuted, Brent. Did you want to respond on the meaning of infamous crime? We see you're unmuted, but I don't hear you, Brent. Jen, did you unmute him?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Oh, what was it you wanted me to respond to?
Yeah, what would you, you know, infamous crime. I understand an infamous crime is a crime that carries a jail sentence or an imprisonment or something, maybe murder or, you know, violent injury or, you know, what is your take on infamous crime?
Well, the word infamous has... The meaning of the word has mutated over time, and it doesn't. The category of infamous crimes is not the same crimes as it was at one time. For example, people say infamous crimes. Well, they say those are crimes of moral turpitude. That's a key word. You can punch that in the computer. That's a synonym, moral turpitude. That's crimes that have to do with cheating, lying, stuff like that. But that's not a hard, fast rule either. It just depends upon what court's talking and what they want to say is moral turpitude. There are cases of going to the Supreme Court trying to decide what a felony is, because federal legislation says, well, anybody that's been convicted of a felony in any of the states, they can't do this anymore. And So there have been cases that come up because state laws will not define things and say this is a felony. So what uniformity and what fairness is there? What uniform application of the law is there if the Congress, the federal government, passes a law that says a felony? Well, a felony in one state may amount to stealing a candy bar, and a felony in another state may not amount to that at all, and the only felony they got is Grand Theft Auto or something. And so each state lists its felonies different, and then
At that point, though, we're getting into statutes, and then statutes cannot be applied against the people. If a person is injured, you know, as we know, the common law says, for every injury must be a remedy. In order for there to be a crime, there must be an injured party. And so with those two rules alone, then it would be up to the people to decide, well, okay, how much of a, you know, if it's a crime, how should we deal with this crime? I mean, the Bible gives us a lot of examples. You know, you steal a man's ox and you got to give him back three or four, whatever it is. So there's a lot of principles there in the Bible for us to follow. But if you get someone, of course, he says, if a man takes another man's life, by man shall his blood be shed. So, you know, the death penalty is in view there. But then it talks about a requirement of two eyewitnesses in order for someone to be executed or something of that nature for murder. So, it gets a little more fine-tuned. The Bible assists us. But let's take something like that, a violent crime against someone. I mean, you know, maybe you do have to incarcerate them. I mean, the idea of not having prisons is a good idea. You know, we spoke about that. How to work. I guess it's up to the people to figure this out, I guess, in that jury box. And that's that.
No, that's right. Because of statutes, and all crimes, by the way, in all states are now statutory. In other words, there's a criminal code, and that defines the crime. And that has confused the definition of felony, misdemeanor, infamous, crimes of moral turpitude, and our common law, by the way, all these words like felony and moral turpitude and infamous, those are all from our common law. And our common law, as the law of the city people say and the rest of the world, is messy. That's why they don't like it. It doesn't come out to an equal equation. There's no elegance to it in appearance. The trials are confusing. There's a fight going on. There's chaos going on in the courtroom. Well, that doesn't occur in France. In France, you just exchange a few papers. Everything's done according to absolute perfect order, and there's no fight. There's no facing of witnesses. There's no defending of rights. There's no passion. There's no oral trial. It's not even oral. The public or the newspapers, as we say, can't come in and evaluate it. So when we talk about infamous felony, for example, crimes and misdemeanors, it says you can impeach the president or a judge of the bench for high crime and misdemeanor. Well, what's that? And, you know, we went through a couple of impeachment. Well, we went through one with Bill Clinton.
In order for the president to be removed, I believe the Constitution requires him to have committed a felony.
Well,
in order for to remove him from office.
Well, yes, but Clinton was not convicted of any felony, but they decided they were going to remove him because they said it was a high crime and a misdemeanor to lie to this grand jury. So
Do you think they could have done that and got away with it?
Well, they came within one vote. Sure, they had done it. Sure, they did the same thing to President Johnson. That was the only other president that we've attempted to remove from office, and we came within one vote that time too. Congress came within one vote. What I'm saying is, the jurisdiction of Congress to do what they want to do has nothing to do with courts. The branches of the government are separate; they're co-equal. If Congress wants to throw somebody out of office, They can do it. And whatever they want to define as a high crime and misdemeanor, that ends the matter. The courts have no say in that as a matter of constitutional law under the separation of powers doctrine. So, again, just to say, there's a confusion, and there is a constant confusion, the common law, of all these terms. What is a high crime? What is a felony? Traditionally, a felony at common law was defined not by the ugliness or the abominableness of the act, rape, mayhem, whatever it is, but it was defined by how long the law said you could go to jail, and traditionally, and this is still true in America, any crime that is jailable potentially for over a year is a felony. That's the standard definition of a felony, but it's not a hard, fast rule, but it's pretty well equally applied that way to define a felony. But then you've got the infamous crimes. Those are crimes that are well known. Rape, arson, murder, larceny. Those are the classic infamous crimes. But that's not a hard, fast definition. Common law does not have hard, fast definitions. Take, for example, get rid of all the statutes, all the criminal statutes in America. How would we know what crime is? Well, we'd go to the court cases, and we'd see how the judges have defined it. And they repeat it and repeat it and repeat it over the decades. What are the elements of burglary? We can learn the elements of burglary at common law according to the opinions of the judges, not according to legislation. It's been said in different ways, but always comes down to the standard definition. Burglary is the breaking and entering of the dwelling house of another at nighttime with intent to commit larceny or felony therein. That's the classic definition, but the courts say it in different ways, use different words, but they keep coming back to the same concepts. That's when there's no criminal statutes, but there are criminal statutes now, so the wording is fixed, and the elements are fixed with certain words, and then those words get defined, the courts start defining. So to say that something is infamous or something is a felony is not clearly defined in our own country, because we are a common law country, because we have 50 separate sovereignties that do what they want. Well, actually 51. Federal government is a separate sovereignty from the rest of the states. Well, that's my take on it, John, for what it's worth, and it's messy. That's no question about that.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to look a little deeper into this 25th Amendment, because I did do a little research, but I didn't take notes on it. And in the case of, for instance, in Section 1, in the case of the removal of the president from office or of his death or resignation, the vice president shall become president, of course. Whenever there is a vacancy in Section 2, Section 3, whenever the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, whenever the vice president. I'll have to look into it, because I know I saw something in here with a felony, that you can only be removed if he has committed a felony. And of course, the only thing that they could do, I believe, is remove him from office, but then he could be tried in a court of justice. But I'm going to look further into that and see once I can find on that. So, thank you, Brent. Okay.
Oh, my pleasure.
I think anything else, Jan? Any other questions?
Yes, I have one more. I'll read the whole thing because it really needs only about one answer. What is the status of the suit against the judicial? Has it been filed? I have limited access to the call, so if you could answer that early on in the call in the question session. Last I heard,
well,
you were proofreading.
We bypassed that possibility.
Yeah, we did.
You should have asked that one first, Jan.
I know.
It's all your fault. It's Jan's fault. Whoever asked that question, it's Jan's fault.
I know there are complexities, but many. I told the gal to check the text that we put up a week later, and she could go right to it then. She wouldn't have to listen to the whole call. I know there are complexities, but many of us made contributions after John said if we could get $5,000, it would be a couple of weeks and we'd have it filed. It's pretty concerning that indication of having the case quickly put into court seemed not to have been honored. Also, 20 books per sheriff seems a little over providing for some of our counties. I'm from Kansas.
Right. Well, on let's go just first to the sheriff's project, okay? We're really far short and in between on collecting enough money. I think we got like $13,000, $14,000. We haven't collected much more than that, and a lot of that really came from two people. Most of that came from two people. But we have a long way to go for the Sheriff's Project, and I'm kind of hoping we'll hit critical mass at some point. People will start to open their pocketbooks and start giving. There are a lot of people that have not given. They can give, but they don't. I don't know why. The work we're doing is very important. Okay, but going back to the first one, okay, which we, long time, again, one person particularly threw in a big donation and covered the pretty much the $5,000 to cover the cost for that case to go into the court, and we're working on that. You know, we've got a lot of things going on here. We've got the New York case. I got an IRS case that I'm keeping on top of. We have the pressures of a lot of different other things, which I haven't been able to pay much attention to. But, Jan, you and me should get together tomorrow and see if I can put some more focus towards some of these other committees and different things we're doing. I know I've been ignoring Jim here in New York, and he's been working on the papers to be filed for nonjudicial foreclosures. I got someone local who wants to do a habeas corpus. I'm considering doing that. I think we have one or two of those still hanging around that I got to talk with Jim about. I'm not sure whether we've completed all that. Crystal's paperwork. Remember last week we spoke a little bit about her paperwork and that I thought that we had filed it, but I wasn't sure. And I did go through the papers and cleaning up all my files, putting them in better order. And I did find her paperwork. We did apply that. So we need to talk to Crystal to see where we can go with her to help her on that case that she's working in Connecticut. But there's a lot of stuff. And the big problem is this. Here's the big problem. We don't have enough volunteers. We ask for people all the time to get involved, get educated, get a hold of Jen. You know, even you don't need a lots of skills. Some people may have lots of skills. And, you know, we can utilize them here or utilize them there. But even the people that maybe have skills that aren't, you know, that involved in the law or in, you know, writing and things of that nature, there's lots of other things to be done to grow this thing. But we're not getting enough volunteers. We're not getting enough money. We do have enough money to file the case. We are filing the case. But it's not going to be filed until it's perfected. You know, and there's one other thing. I don't want to share too much about this, but, you know, I've got a medical problem. It's really some pain that I have to deal with, and I went on to a particular pharmaceutical that I didn't find out until after I went on to it was a controlled substance. They're trying to get me off of one controlled substance that I take very little of and put me on something else. They don't tell me how dangerous it is. I'm walking around almost hallucinating and driving and not even realizing I'm stoned. And I could have killed somebody, and I had to go to my pharmacist to find out how dangerous this was. So I had to come off of that, and it took me a week, maybe a week and a half, to really completely clean out from that. What would you call it when you come off a drug?
Detox.
Took me over a week to detox. I was scratching like I was some kind of junkie. It was just insane. I mean, so that's just a personal.
You're lucky it only took a week, and let me tell you why. You could be sick for months on stuff like that.
Yes, I read, and they did say that. Yes, and so I am kind of cured from that now, but that has held me back a good week and a half or more. A lot of stress I've had, and other things. People need my personal help, and a lot of things. But let me tell you something. Putting these cases together. Getting it right, there's a lot involved in it. You know, everything's got to be perfected. And once you get it together, just imagine this. I don't know how many pages we're going to end up having. Less is better. I don't know how many memorandums we're going to use in opposed to putting this information right inside the case. We have to think that out. But everything needs to be, after it's all done and said, it still has to be perfected numerous times over. The amount of time just going through reading it out loud with other people, fixing the English, fixing the punctuation, maybe changing a few words around, restructuring, clearing up a thought that wasn't too well laid out, or maybe it's a half a thought. Maybe I thought I got a whole thought on paper and only got half the thought. That happens too. And so there's a lot of work to be done. And if people need or think that we should be moving faster, then we need more people to volunteer. We need more help. And if we don't get it, we're going to move at the snail's pace we're at. But there's also another philosophy, strategy, belief that I personally hold, and that everything is right on time. As late as we may think we are, as early as we may think we are neither. We are right on time. And the reason I say that is because I truly believe – with my heart and soul, that we are doing God's work. What we are trying to do is bringing back the king of the court back to rule in his court. And without that king, there is no court of justice. Okay? And that's the common law court. And that's our goal. That's what we're doing. And if he's going to bless that work, and I look to see how we've progressed, how things have turned to where they are. Again, I'm kind of depressed with the number of people that actually give the money and time. And some people don't have the time, but surely if they don't have that much time, they must be pretty busy. Maybe they got more money they can help us out with, but they don't do that either. We need more money. We need more time. We need more help. And I don't think it's fair for anyone to really make a statement that we're not doing well enough, or we're not doing quick enough, or we're not fulfilling what we'd like to fulfill when we just don't have enough people working to help us out. Okay? So the answer to the question is I can't even be solid on this anymore. We've got 70 pages of information kind of thrown together, and now we're trying to categorize it. And then we still haven't even, after we do all that, we then have to work on the synopsis to really put it together in some kind of a, you know, digestible way that makes sense and clear on what our case is about, what we're looking for, and what we're expecting of these people, okay? And how we expect to even go forward. You know, that's another plan. You know, these are extraordinary situations, things, papers, positions, thinking that we're doing here. This is we get to a lot of places where there is no history to fall upon. There is no place to say, well, this is how it's done, because we haven't been here before. And we're here for the first time, and it's okay, because we, the people, have the power and the authority. We created this nation. We ordained and established the laws of this nation. We called upon the Creator to have his courts of justice to be judged in, if it's necessary to be done so. And we've done all the things, and we can continue to build upon that and make the things necessary that we, the people, believe and feel that is right and just, and what on how things have to work. And right now, we are winging it, and we've got a lot of stuff we put together to leverage and to kind of fortify or give good foundations on why we're going this way, why we're going that way. But again, it gets back to articulating. And if I could have 2 weeks, literally, of uninterrupted time, no phone calls, no cell phone calls, no phone calls on my computer, no other jobs that I have to be involved with, or conversations, or meetings, or interviews, or any of those things. And if I can apply 2 weeks without any disruption, well, I think I can accomplish it. And I've been working like the devil to try to get that time. But, life has held me back. Just activities, different things has held me back. And the bottom line, no matter where we go, no matter what we say, no matter where we're at, we're right on time. We're exactly where we're meant to be. Because if we're going to believe that the will of God is behind us, because we will not succeed at this without the will of God, we have to have the proper mindset. We have to have a godly mind, a godly focus, a biblical view. And we have to be exercising those biblical views, not only in the things we're doing, but in the life that we're living to the best of our abilities. If we're not doing those things, then we're not doing the will of the Father after all, are we? And we're not really getting his blessings, are we? And we're not on time at all anyway, if that's the case, are we? But if we are doing his will, and we are doing what the best that we can do, what we believe is right, and fix whatever errors we have as we move along, then we're right on time. Anything else, Jen?
No, that was it.
Okay. We're going to move over to Brent. Let's see, Gerard, are you ready to take the controls here?
Yeah.
Gerard, okay.
Yeah, before, can you hear me? Look, yeah. Before we move to Brent, I just want to put this in perspective for what Donald Trump has done with federal judges, because I Googled it quick, just so people understand what he's been doing. I looked up a list of federal judges appointed by Donald Trump, okay, and Wikipedia has a pretty good article on it. And it says, this is a comprehensive list of all the Article 3 and Article 4 United States federal judges appointed by Donald Trump during his presidency, as well as a partial list of Article 1 federal judges, well, we know about that, appointments, excluding appointments to the District of Columbia's judiciary. As of September 22, 2018, the United States Senate has confirmed 68 Article 3 judges nominated by President Trump, including one Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, whatever that is, of the United States, 26 Justices of the United States Court of Appeals, 41 Judges for the United States District Courts, 0 Judges for the United States Court of International Trade. There are currently 73 nominations to Article III courts awaiting Senate action, so that's to be coming, 73, including 1 for the Supreme Court, 10 for the Courts of Appeals, 64 vacancies on the U.S. District Courts, 2 vacancies on the U.S. Court of International Trade, and 25 announced federal judges vacancies that will occur on or before the end of Trump's term, 5 for the Court of Appeals and 20 for the District Courts. And I don't know if you know what's going on there, but as they uncover more and more crimes, these judges are leaving because he's told them, get out now. That's why there's a big exodus. Trump has not made any recess appointments to the judicial federal courts. Let's see. In terms of Article I courts, as of August 26, 2018, the Senate has confirmed 7 judges nominated by Trump, including 2 for the United States Tax Court, 4 for the United States Action, whatever that is, including 3 for the United States Court of Federal Claims, 4 for the Court, and 1 for the United States Court of Military Commission Review. Trump, in terms of Article, my glasses
did,
on,
did
looks
it say,
like four.
Did it say that he filled tax court positions or that he's got upcoming tax court positions
no,
to
he,
be filled?
No, he filled them.
He filled them because, you see, that's a problem. U.S. Title 26 is just nothing but gibberish. I mean, there is absolutely nothing worth anything to be useful in that code at all that I have discovered. And the whole thing is nothing but fraud on top of fraud meant to confuse people and to just get you so disgusted that you say, I'm just going to pay the tax. And no one could figure anything out. And anything that they send you, read their papers, and it's just gibberish. It's ridiculousness. And so U.S. 26 has no application. There is no authority for a tax court whatsoever. Now, that doesn't mean that that Congress can't put together administrative process to deal with tax situations concerning corporations and things, and maybe that should fall under what's Title 26. And maybe some of the stuff in Title 26 it can be or is applied there. I don't know. But it is to be is to have no inference of law at all. It is not law. It says so in U.S. 26. It has no jurisdiction. It has not been, judged by Congress as law. I'm thinking of the proper word to use for that, but for lack of that word. Congress has not made it law. And the jurisdiction, I don't even think it gives a jurisdiction. Well, I think it does maritime. I don't remember. I'm going to go back and look in 26 to see what jurisdiction it maybe even applies, if any. But again, all of these things have nothing to do with we the people. And there is absolutely, without any doubt, any kind of a debate, I don't care what you do, you can't make any logical position that an Article I court has ever been given the authority to any Congress to make anything called such a thing as an Article I court. The courts described as far as the type of courts is in Article 3, which is courts of law and equity, and it gives the authorities and what the jurisdiction is right there in Article 3, and then in Article 2 it empowers Congress to set forth the tribunals, which means to get the judges together to put judges into positions to fill these courts that Congress makes. And there's lots of courts that need to be made. I mean, it's not just the courts of equity and the courts of law. It's the courts of every jurisdiction within all of these titles, which of only 27 hasn't been enacted, and that's the word I was looking for, enacted. Only 27 of the titles have been enacted. So there's really only 27 proper jurisdictions and different courts, but they nevertheless, they have to be subservient still, no matter how you do it, under Article 3, under subjection of the Constitution, that every judge must obey, okay? And I can't believe that I see the makings of an Article I court on the United States Supreme Court page. I've seen it up there. I've seen it on the federal district pages. I have no clue. And where they reference it, there's no power, no authority, nothing. So, again, we get back to ignorance. How can so many people be so ignorant? Who are we listening to that we remain ignorant? I can't understand that. I better call me a bar attorney, you know, because he's going to explain it to. And they have no clue. They're just talking about what they've been taught by the New World Order control schools or bar associations or whatever you want to call them. And very few people go through a school that's not necessarily directly underneath the bar. Okay, most schools throughout the United States appear to be underneath that. But nevertheless, all lawyers got to take the bar test, you know, they have to pass the bar. So, and well, that makes sense. I'm good with that. But let's put it to its proper perspective where it belongs, and let's remove from there what they think any control over courts of justice. Gerard?
I don't think it's any more difficult than playing Simon Says, and I think you misunderstood what I was talking about before.
Oh, no. I wasn't disagreeing with what you said.
No, I mean, as far as what their code says, like, you know, I don't know if you remember that lawyer that wrote that you can't bring the Constitution up in your case because the courts aren't
right.
going to do a de novo examination of a statute because they've already written codes on top of that statute that says those statutes are presumed constitutional, that they've withstood the muster of constitutional.
Well, all
you know,
they have to do
scrutiny.
Is obey the United States Supreme Court rulings then, because there's
well,
a lot of great
know,
rulings there.
What they're doing is the same thing the doctor did to you. You go to the
yes.
doctor, he prescribes a drug. You get symptoms from that drug. He doesn't consider that the drug is causing symptoms. He gives you a new drug to counteract the symptoms from the drug that he just gave you. And at the end of the
day...
Oh,
yeah, and it did cause another problem that I complained to him about. He sent me to another
right.
doctor
they
to deal with that
them.
Problem. I said, wait a second here. Why don't I just stop taking... I'm going to put drug on top of drug on top of drug. What is this? Of course, I already had that argument ready as soon as he...
60
you know.
Years ago or so... 50 years ago, whatever it was, 50, 60 years ago, my mother figured out that the doctors had her on all kinds of medicine and nothing was getting better. And she had asthma and she had this problem and that problem. So finally she went and got a PDR and she looked up the medicines they had her on. Now, she had asthma, but she also had a woman problem where her menstrual period wouldn't go away. And they'd send her and they'd do a D&C and then she'd be good for a couple of months and then back and forth to go. Come to find out that the asthma medicine caused the uterine bleeding that they were sending her to the gynecologist for, who never looked up the asthma medicine that she was on that was causing the problem. So they're feeding,
mm-hmm.
this is way back when. My mother died at 89. So this is way back when she was having children. They're still doing the same thing. And the same thing with the tax courts and that, because everybody's assuming that what they're doing is legal. And one of the reasons they don't want you bringing the Constitution up, especially in the lower courts, number one, they've been trained that they don't have the mind to make a constitutional decision, and nothing could be further from the truth. They should be making those decisions in the lower court because the Constitution is not that complicated, and if they don't know
That's
it,
right.
they have no business sitting there. So they've
That's
got
right.
these guys convinced that only the Supreme Court can rule on constitutional decisions, so you never get your justice. They say, oh, no.
Well, that's their excuse.
Right, it's an excuse, and I'll tell you why it's an excuse, because if you could go in the lower court and make the case that this particular statute should have never applied to you in the first place, it has no jurisdiction, and that they're wronging you, guess what happens? All the other people that they've convicted under that, they're liable for that. They don't want to talk about that because that opens
up.
Well,
they're liable anyway, no matter how you do. Once they apply a statute to the
people,
they're liable.
This keeps the lid on the pot, you understand?
From their perspective, yeah.
That's right. This is the Wizard of Oz. Just click your heels together, Dorothy, and poof, it goes away. Now, what I was talking about in the tax code, look at, if Simon doesn't say jump and you jump, you're done. You don't need to go there in the first place because it doesn't, this is what David Merlin says, it doesn't apply to you. You don't need to rest the Title 26 because right from the word go, your employer should not be reporting that as income. And if we could get our employers to stop, and he gives you the law that the Supreme Court ruled on that says that the employer should not be reporting income, that's income not minus your expenses. So you don't need to read their tax code because you're not performing those things. So they don't address that. They jump over that, and they just consider, like you said, John, when you get a check, they treat the whole thing as income. And that's what they're doing.
And that's their way to undress before them. So you have to come in and explain everything.
Right.
And then sign their papers and along the line of the X and all that other stuff. That's their big game.
Yeah,
because
you have no jurisdiction. This is not income. I didn't make income. As per the Supreme Court already ruled on it. But they got
Remember when we went down to the federal court in the Southern District and we only went in there once, and then I got all that paperwork on the IRS case and so on and so forth. But anyway, one of the things that I mentioned to the judge, and I also put it in writing, that I could not get any conclusion here. I used a different word, justice. I don't think I used the word justice, but remedy. I couldn't
get
remedy
from that court.
Okay.
Right.
You know what? I want to tell you something. That phrase may have been the key phrase on that case, because we know there are about three or four different phrases that could have affected this. We know we're looking at the fiduciary
proof of claim, and, right,
Form 56 and the 4490.
Right.
Okay, those played an important role, but I'll tell you what, I'm beginning to think. Because I saw a different composer, now that I think back, and maybe, and I don't know if I'm in adding to my mind, you know, the way the brain works sometimes, you're not even sure really what really took place sometimes. But I thought there was a difference in composure there at that point, and it was kind of like, okay, let's move along here now. And that might have been one of the key things there, and the fact that that claim was put there. Now, what were they trying to apply there? We were in a court that we had opened, not a court that they had opened, and we're going up against the status quo. We're going up against the Title 26 and the IRS and all that other stuff. And even when I tried to make the case of the point to the fact that it was a private corporation, it's neither federal nor does it have any reserve there. He didn't want to hear any of that. But we did make that in the paperwork. It's in the paperwork anyway. But anyway, I think that played an important role in that case, maybe. And that's what we really need to think about. You know, if you're in a court that can't give you remedy, then there can be no justice at all. And once that point is made, and if it's a true statement, guess what? That judge has got to get rid of that case, doesn't he?
If he believes that
it can apply.
I think you wrote it in such a fashion that it put the judge's coattails on the line, too. Now, that was a judge that actually read your paperwork, and we know that he read your paperwork.
Oh, yeah.
Because he said, and you're making a claim that because you're the head of a Liberty group, they're targeting you, and that week is when the tape came out from Lois Lerner where she admitted, somebody released the tape where she admitted on a telephone call that, yes, she was pressured to go after Patriot tax-exempt groups. And that happened that week. Yeah, and that happened that week that you went to court. That was the big news released. So I think there was a few things that lined up the stars in heaven for you there, so to speak, that made him make that decision, because he was feeling the heat, I think, by the way you wrote the paperwork. And you had sued everybody. You know what I mean? You sued the clerk, the sheriff, this one, that one. And
anybody
knew,
who could touch my money.
Right. So he figured he was next.
Well,
you
he
know,
was.
And then you included those terms that he understood. He goes, okay, I don't want to mess with this guy because he understands the language. He's using the right terminology.
And he
That's
probably presumed more than I should have deserved to have been presumed.
Right,
because...
but look, you were getting dangerous. Look, I always tell everybody I know just enough to make me dangerous, and that's not a bad thing all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, anyway.
All right, well, let's move on. I want to move on to Brent in a minute, but before I move to Brent, there's just two or three more things I want to make points of. I'm not going to spend much time. We've already discussed it. We've had these papers done for quite some time. I thought we had them up online. Someone requested them. I got the Jan, you got those papers on the amendments. And I'm going to put them up online in 13th, 14th, 16th, and 17th Amendment. I'm not sure exactly where or how I'll put them, but I'll try to put them into an appropriate and obvious place. But if someone quizzes me next week, hopefully I'll have it done. Again, more jobs for me to do, and this takes away my time. But it's important for me to get these things up on the line, and it doesn't take too long to put that up. But one of the other two other things I want to do, and I don't know anybody, I don't know how many people are following X22. If you're following anything and you only have time to watch one thing, I strongly suggest X22. That is the one to listen to. That is the one to follow. He comes up with two or three things a day. He does an interview maybe two or three times a week. He does an interview with certain individuals. Fascinating stuff. So informative. And he puts a lot of information. He does some heavy-duty research, I'm sure, and everything that Q puts out. So I guess he's really reading, following, and looking into all of the different websites and different pages and stories out there that Q puts out. And I'm sure he's doing his other researches, but he gets the whole thing, the whole package together beautifully. And if you really don't have the time to spend any more than maybe an hour a day, X22 is the ones to listen to. And I feel so strong about that, I'm considering, and I may do this tomorrow, of putting a page on there just on X22, because that's the following that you really want to get. They're already up there on our website, but I want to get that up there. The other thing, I've been following this guy, Steve Bannon, and I've been talking a little bit to Jan and Gerard about him, and the more and more I listen, the more and more I'm blown away. He articulates the problem so well, and he is so quick on his feet, and he's been in numerous debates, numerous interviews. He always comes out sparkling, and I realize what he's doing. He's been working, ultimately, he picked up back in 2010 particularly is when the Tea Party started to really surge up. Prior to that, it was the Ron Paul movement, and it morphed into the Tea Party movement. And he picked up on that back in 2010. And he's been driving that. And, of course, he's become he was involved in the campaign to elect Trump, and he really laid a lot of things out that really, I think, helped Trump tremendously to become elected. He'll make the point over and over again. Trump got himself elected, but he did give him some great advice. And he was also a chief advisor to the president for 8 months in the beginning of his administration. But he's called an extremist, and when you listen to him, believe me, he's a true patriot, lays everything out, and he's working on the grassroots level, not only here in the United States, but also around the world, internationally. And the work that this guy is doing, and the conversations that he's having, and the debates that he's making, the positions that he's holding, the articulation of what he understands on how things work and his response to the people, and even the simplicity of his background of who he was, you know, as just a person, a regular guy, you know, just like one of us, a regular person, no one special. And yet his work, I think, is so important to know and understand, to see how big this movement is, not only here in the United States, where he claims it's two-thirds of the population is in a movement to bring this nation back to its roots. Two-thirds, that's pretty big. And he does make a case about something with three-quarters. But he also makes the case that this has become an international movement. And in many, many countries, some of these nations are even ahead of us on the game on some of this stuff. But if you really want to understand what's going on and how this game is played, and again, you need to, you know, if you listen to one debate and another one and another one, another one, or an interview, or, you know, after a while, you're hearing a lot of things over and over again to some degree, and then you start to really get it. He is really making the path, so to speak, for what Trump is doing. And he articulates these things so well. In one of his conversations or debates or lectures or whatever you want to call it, because it happens. You know, he talks in different modes. He makes a point in passing, which I thought was very interesting. He says, I kind of look at myself, you know, he's come out of the administration. He was, quote-unquote, fired by the administration, released. Okay, again, part of the game. This was important, I think, to happen that way. He's on the outside working. And he refers to himself, he kind of looks at himself as being Donald Trump's wingman. And I thought that was an interesting statement. And so his work is important to us as patriots, as people that have come out of the Liberty Movement, still in the Liberty Movement, and to see the workings of so many more people, not only here in the United States, but around the world, and how much people really know and understand what is really going on here. It's pretty amazing. It's uplifting. It's really helpful to give us sort of a boost in the arm, so to speak, to know that we are coming with great numbers, and people understand. So anyway, those two things, Bannon, Steve Bannon, I think I may make a page just for him to understand his movement and post things as they come about. And also on the X-22, again, I might make a page just for that, as being, if you don't have time to listen to a lot of things, listen to this one. Okay, and he covers the Q, statements on a daily basis, but he really takes the roundabout. He rounds off all the things. He makes it very comprehensive and just cohesive. I don't know what else to say here on that. Okay, with that, we're going to move to Brent. Gerard, you got the controls here. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. And Brent, you got the mic. Okay, I'm waiting for Brent to unmute himself. I think it's just a star six, Brent, if I recall. Okay.
Yeah, I'm good, I think. My name is Brent Alan Winters, and my comments are my own. They do not belong to anyone else but me, and I take responsibility for them. They may or may not be the position, the views of the principles of National Liberty Alliance, but they have been kind enough week by week to allow me to say a few words, and I appreciate it. It is the instinct of people, when they find themselves in a crisis, to instinctively turn their eyes toward their origins and look there for a sign. That's a famous quote. I can't remember who said it, but it wasn't me. But it's the truth, and history bears that out. It reminds me of Elijah when he had the showdown with the prophets of Baal, demon worshipers. 800 of them. 800 priests of Baal. And he ended up, before it was over, you can read the account of yourself, but he single-handedly beheaded all of them. Doesn't go into detail about how he did that, but it was quite a physical feat to have done that. And then, though, after he did that, he was struck with fear because a woman by the name of Jezebel was running the government. And she was a nasty old witch. Beautiful, too, by the way, in her younger years. And so he fled for his life. And he fled from up there along the Mediterranean coast, clean down into Egypt. And he ran all the way down there. Or by foot, probably taking him a few days. And he wanted to go back to that mountain. He wanted to go back to that mountain where Moses received from the hand of the true lawgiver himself on the mountain, received what we today call the Ten Commandments. But his eyes in that moment of crisis instinctively turned toward the origins of his nation. and he looked there for a sign. He ran back there, and he waited for God to talk to him. And he didn't see God in anything spectacular, but finally he heard that still, small voice of God. And the true lawgiver is the true lawgiver of our nation, according to our organic documents, namely the Declaration of 76 references. The true lawgiver we call God. James the Apostle calls him the true lawgiver. He says there's only one true lawgiver, and he's talking about the creator of heaven and earth. And our Declaration of 76 references him four times. And he has given us two volumes of revelation of true law, the laws of nature unwritten in the nature of things, and the laws of nature of God written in the Bible. That's what Blackstone tells us that phrase means. It was well known when our Declaration was written. Blackstone wrote of it 10, 11 years before our Declaration was written. And so our Constitution of the United States is an exercise of the laws of nature as God, unwritten in the nature of things observed, namely our law of the land. That's what our Constitution calls itself. That is an old phrase meaning due process, meaning also our common law. That's what our common law is, a way, a means, a path, a course of going about determining verdicts and what is right and what is wrong and how things are done. So we're going through our Constitution of the United States. We went through the Declaration of 76. We're not going fast, but taking it as it comes, clause by clause, blow by blow. We're in Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 of the United States Constitution. It says this. I read it last time, but I'll just briefly go over this and then move on. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included within this union, according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, excluding Indians not taxed, and 3/5 of all other persons. Well, Amendment 14 modifies this simply because our common law and our Constitution, which is a brief of common law government, forbid slavery now, and so this part of the clause talking about bound to service, indentured servanthood for a term of years, and free persons per persons versus unfree persons, that's no longer applicable. Let's move on to the next section. Section 2, Clause 4 of Article 1 says, the actual enumeration shall be made, that is the census, that's what he's talking about. The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States and within every subsequent term of 10 years. So every 10 years there's supposed to be a census. And it shall be done in such manner, it says, as they, that is Congress, shall direct by law. Now notice something here. It does not say as the bureaucrats shall direct by law, or as the president shall direct by law, or as the courts shall direct by law. It says that the Congress of the United States is to take a census every 10 years as they, plural, who's they? Well, all of those congressmen shall direct by law. And if that were followed, that would do away with a whole lot of the baloney that's on these census forms, including how many firearms you may or may not have in your house. So the congressman starts asking that kind of questions and on the census form, then people would want to throttle him when he came back to the district. See, the president doesn't come back to any district. He's just the president, and he's untouchable. And so when he directs that or allows the Census Bureau, the bureaucracy, to do these ugly things, then it's hard to get hold of him. You can get hold of your congressman a little better. You can get hold of your state representative even better than that. They fear the people, and if they fear the people, then we have a little freedom instead of the people fearing them. So Congress is to direct how the census is to be taken. It says the number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative, and until such enumeration shall be made, the state of New Hampshire, well, it goes to the states what they are at that time. So this census clause empowers the general government in Washington, D.C. to number the persons living in each state, beginning with the year 1790. And I'd mentioned last time, U.S. Marshals took the first census here in the United States in the year 1790. And then Congress established or enacted by legislation what's called the Census Bureau in the year 1902. And the framers of our Constitution knew that a representative representation of more than 30,000 persons is meaningless. However, in 1929, Congress restricted the House of Representatives to 435 members. The purpose of tallying the population in each state is twofold: to determine the number of representatives each state will send to the Congress of the United States, and to enable the burden of direct taxes to be laid on each state in proportion to its population. You see, you can't apportion federal taxes according to the state's population unless you take a census. The reason for the census is to be able to tax the states according to their respective populations. Really, there is no greater reason than that. That's why we say again, all of the other questions that are asked on the census form are unconstitutional, because the federal government has no powers that the Constitution of the United States does not give to it explicitly, and the Constitution of the United States does not give explicitly to the federal government any authority to ask any questions other than how many people live in your house. That's it. Anything beyond that is unlawful. I say that with confidence because I can read the Constitution. And I hasten to add, though, that's the law. By the way, the word de jure means of law. De jure means of law. De facto means of fact. And the reason that those words, you didn't find them, I haven't looked, but somebody said they didn't find them in the 1828 dictionary of Mr. Webster. The reason they aren't there, a lot of words aren't there that we think maybe ought to be there, is because when he put that dictionary together in 1828, his purpose was to establish a new language that was called American. And he knew it needed to be English, but he wanted it to be a new dialect of English. And he took the definitions for his words as close as he could tell them out of the King James Bible. Now, he himself translated the Bible also. I've got a copy of his Bible translation. I'm convinced that what he did, no man could do all the things he tried to do and do a good job on all of them together, or do the best job he could have done. That man worked with tirelessly to try to preserve his country. He did so many things. He tried to establish a language for America. He wrote textbooks for all the school children in America. That one task of trying to do a dictionary and translated the Bible. He claimed he did it from the original tongues. I think he consulted them pretty heavily, but it seems that he still probably leaned heavily on some of the older English translations too, like, of course, the King James Version, which was really the only one that was readily available. But you can get a copy of his Bible translation, Webster's translation of the Holy Bible. Well, in short, the framers of our Constitution pictured a simple head count of people living in each state so that each state's representatives in Congress would be fair for purposes of taxation. Bottom line, the Constitution never empowers government to collect more information than the number of persons in each household. I said that. Oh, back to that dictionary. I forgot to mention another thing. De facto and de jure. The reason, if those words aren't there, as it said, the reason they're not there is because they're Latin words. And Webster's purpose for his dictionary was to establish an American language. And he didn't want any Latin words in the American language. But it is true that some things are de facto, some things are de jure, for instance. De jure is that the law, de jure means of law. Of law is that Congress is to direct the manner in which the census shall be taken. But de facto, the fact of the matter is, that's not the way it's done. That's the difference between de jure and de facto. People often say to me, have often said over the years, they come to me with the reason, the rolling stock of reason knocked off the rails because some cop beat them up or some cop came into their home and tossed the place without a warrant or busted the door down, did something that is contrary to our Constitution. And they'll, in frustration and confusion, say they can't do that. Well, de jure, of law, they're not supposed to. That's right. But de facto, in fact, that's what they did. So that's the difference, again, between, you know, one means it's lawful, the law permits it, and the other one means that this is the fact of the matter. We live in a world where the fact of the matter, what really goes on, what government employees do, is more de facto than it is de jure. They're just doing things, and that's the fact of the matter, doing a lot of unlawful things. And the law says something else. Section 2, Clause 5. When vacancies happen in the representation from any state, the executive authority thereof shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies. I thought I went over that already, but maybe I didn't. I think I did. So I'm gonna, it just means that, I remember now the governor, if there's a vacancy, is to issue a writ. A writ is a command from a greater to a lesser. A writ is a command from a greater to a lesser. So a writ of habeas corpus is a command from a court to a jailer, a greater to a lesser, one with more authority in that particular situation, commanding the jailer to bring the prisoner in question before the court and show cause if he's why you have jailed him and if it's lawful, so the court can decide. That's a writ. And here we have writs of election issued from a governor, a greater, to a bureaucrat, the Board of Elections, to set it up and have an election. Section 2, Clause 6, the House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers and shall have the sole power of impeachment. This clause requires the House of Representatives to choose and seat a Speaker of the House. Its method of doing so is the House's choice and no others. They may want to do it by majority vote. They may want to do it by one-third vote. They may want to do it by two-thirds vote. Whatever they decide to set up as rules, that's their business. And they are an independent branch of government. And if they don't do anything but just make a mockery of it, that's their business, and there's not anything the courts can do about it. Not anything the President of the United States can do about it. When the House of Representatives cheats or doesn't follow what people consider to be due process, that's nobody's business but their own. That's our doctrine of separation of powers. I've read the Congressional Record and discovered that federal judges sitting on the bench were never, the Senate never confirmed their nomination by the president, and they're sitting on the bench anyway, because the Senate of the United States couldn't get couldn't even get it to the floor to vote on this fellow the president had proposed to be a federal judge. Never got it to the floor to vote on it, never voted on it. Yet, he went away and ahead and seated himself as a federal judge and been there for years. I read the congressional record. I know that to be a fact. What I'm saying is the congressional record said they took no vote. There never was a vote taken. They just, somebody wrote in the record, whoever was filling out the records, said affirm. This judge is affirmed. That's it. Nobody can question that. No court can question it. It's none of their business. If that's what the Senate of the United States approves of the record of the Senate, then that judge is affirmed, even though they didn't vote on it. Because the Constitution of the United States never tells the Congress how to conduct their inner workings. Just as courts have no jurisdiction in the United States to tell a church how to conduct its inner workings. That's off limits. It's none of their business. As a matter of constitutional law. Let's go to the next one. Section 3, Clause 1. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of 2 senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have 1 vote. Now, this clause requires that each state legislature pick its state's 2 senators for Congress. That's the way it used to be done. Well, yes, it does say that here. Chosen by the legislature thereof of your state. But Amendment number 17 of our Constitution changes this clause, requiring the voters of each state to choose their state's senators for the federal Congress by a majority, thereby weakening the people's stake in state legislator elections, inciting senators to manipulate the people. You know, senators used to, over 100 years ago, they used to try to get voted into office by being nice to state representatives and getting the support of the people. Case in point, the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858 traveled around the states with 2 fellows, one very tall and one very short. Judge Douglas was a short man, a New Englander, by the way, that had immigrated to Illinois. And Lincoln was a tall man. He was born in Kentucky and grew up in Indiana and migrated across the Wabash River over into Illinois. And they decided to have a series of debates all over the state of Illinois. About 6 of them, I believe. But what they were trying to do, you know, they knew that the state legislature was the one that would decide who would get to be Senate. But they knew also that if they persuaded the people of the state of Illinois to put the pressure on the legislators, vote the ones into the office of legislature that would vote for them, that would help them get elected. That's why they decided to travel around the state and make those speeches. Amazingly, Lincoln lost the election. The legislature of Illinois did not choose him for United States Senator. But those debates with Senator Douglas catapulted Abe Lincoln into the national eye, and that is what enabled him to become president of the United States. So it is said, and rightly said, that everything that goes on in America, even though we have sovereign states, independent one of the other, and a sovereign general government in Washington, D.C., independent of the states, and that's in one sense. In another sense, it's all the same government at different levels and different sovereignties, and that's true. Our whole nation is under the Constitution of the United States while maintaining state sovereignty at the same time and under the Constitution of each state. Well, immediately, Section 3, Clause 2, immediately after the Senate shall be assembled in consequence of the first election for United States Senators. They shall be divided as equally as may be into three classes. The seats of each of the senators of the first class shall be vacated at the expiration of the second year, of the second class at the expiration of the fourth year, and of the third class at the expiration of the sixth year, so that one-third of the senators may be chosen every second year, and we still do it that way. Why do we do that? Why don't we just vote for all the senators every 6 years? Well, the reason we don't do that is because the United States Senate, by contrast to the United States House of Representatives, is to be a more deliberative, slow-moving, contemplative body of lawmakers on purpose. You see, a United States congressman stands for election every 2 years. A United States congressman cannot afford to stop campaigning. As Blackwell used to say, good politics is good campaigning, and good campaigning is good politics. You can't separate the two. And a United States House of Representative member can never stop campaigning if he wants to stay in office. Everything he does is calculated to be campaigning, to get him back into office. And he, because he has to stand for election every 2 years, he responds quickly to the heartbeat of his district, the voters. That's the way the Constitution is designed. Whereas the Senate and the senators are not so quick in knee-jerk reaction because their term lasts 6 years. They don't have to worry about re-election every 2 years. That's the difference between the two houses. But to add more to the deliberative, slow contemplation of the United States Senate, that body isn't allowed to change every 2 years. As a matter of fact, you see this election coming up now. The Democrats think that they can overturn Congress and just take control of the House of Representatives. That's easier to do than it is to control the Senate, because only one-third of the senators will stand for election this election. Only one-third. Whereas all 435 members of the House of Representatives will stand for election every 2 years. Thus, it is intended that the United States Senate be older, that you have to be 30 years old, according to our Constitution, to be a United States Senator. You only have to be 25 years old to be a U.S. Congressman. You say, what's the difference between 5 years? Well, if you've been a man, of course, I know half the population hasn't been a man, but men understand this. Men slow down and become more deliberative. The impulses of their hormones don't rage quite so hard. And so by the time they're 30, the slowing down process begins in earnest. And those of us that have lived through that understand that. I don't know about the female of the species. That's a totally different thing. But that's the way men are built, and that's what the framers of our Constitution, they're trying to take advantage of that rhythm of the life and the cycle of men. One more clause, and then we'll call it a day. Section 3, Clause 2. Well, we did that. Let's see. Let me say this. I mentioned here, and this ought to be said, I like the word staggered. The elections of senators are staggered, and our Constitution thereby gives us a stable, slow-moving, sure-footed, regular body of legislators, less blown about by the ever-shifting foolishness of political winds. Now, U.S. senators, you'll notice they don't move so fast, and you'll notice that the House of Representatives is subject to knee-jerk reactions in a way the Senate isn't for that reason. If vacancies happen by resignation or otherwise during the recess of the legislature of any state, the executive thereof may make temporary appointments until the next meeting of the state legislature, which shall then fill such vacancies. You see, that was meaningful in the day when state legislatures chose the United States senators. Again, Amendment 17 modifies this clause, changing the method of filling empty Senate seats. It says here that the governors of the state, if the state legislature is out of session and therefore can't fill the senator's seat, then the senator or the governor may appoint a senator to fill in until an election can be had. Section 3, Clause 3 says this: no person shall be senator who shall not have attained to the age of 30 years and been 9 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state for which he shall be chosen. To become a member of the United States Senate, the candidate must be 30 years old, it says, and have been a citizen of the United States for at least 9 years. That's number two. And the third requirement, he must have, at the time of his election, he must, at that point, when he's elected, live in the state that has chosen him. And our Constitution of the United States has no other qualifications beyond these three. Therefore, as I'd said 2 or 3 weeks ago, a candidate for Senate theoretically can run for Senate in one state while residing in another. I think there was a gal named Hillary that did that. But the Senate cannot lawfully seat the senator-elect unless, when elected, he lives in the state that chose him. And we talked about the minimum age is 5 years older than one running for House of Representatives. I question a fellow 25 years old being a member of the House of Representatives. I knew of a fellow, met him, that was 25 years old, and he was a member of the House of Representatives. Yeah, I question that. But that's what the Constitution says. Seems like that's awful young. Simply put, it'll get a fellow in trouble. By the way, this one got trouble. He got trouble. He was young enough that he had not control of the raging of the rhythms of his hormones. The representative's younger age will incline him to the majority's pressing passions. We mentioned that. Section 3, Clause 4. The Vice President of the United States shall be President of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they, that is, the senators, are equally divided, and he will be the tiebreaker. By admitting states into the Union so as to maintain at any given time an even number of states, Congress can keep the Vice President from using his powerful tie-breaking Senate vote. The executive offices, such as the Vice President's powerful check by veto on the legislative office, that's the Senate. Though the Vice President is the official President of the Senate, he rarely presides, and rarely has in our history, except on special occasions. The Vice President of the United States' chief role is the tiebreaker of votes of the United States Senate. Thank you. Back to you, Gerard. And if you don't come on, Gerard, I'll keep talking, but we're getting close to the end of the time here. But if you're there, just chime in. And in the meantime, I'll say a few more words since I don't hear anything. Section 3, Clause 5. We've got 9 minutes. The Senate shall choose their officers and also a president pro tempore in the absence of the Vice President, or when he shall exercise the office of President of the United States. What this clause is saying is, if the Vice President of the United States becomes the President of the United States, then the Senate must choose a president pro tempore. That means temporary, a temporary president. Fancy word, I don't know why they use it. could have just said temporary, I suppose. Maybe they didn't do that back in that day. But that's all that means. The phrase president pro tempore means, watch this, to put it in more precise words, it means president for the time being. See, temporary is a word taken from the Latin word for time, and pro is understood preposition for. It means for the time being, temporary. That is, in the absence of the real president of the Senate, which is the vice president of the United States. The president, pro tempore, of the Senate is third in line of succession, by the way, to the office of president after the Speaker of the House of Representatives. If something happens to the president of the United States, the vice president, vice, has the same meaning as vicar. And it has the same meaning as viceroy. Those are three dialects of the Latin languages. Viceroy is French. But all of vicar, of course, as the Latin-rooted words, vice, vicar, viceroy, all mean in place of. In place of. And if something happens to the president, the vice president is to take office in place of the president. If something happens to the vice president, then the Speaker of the House of Representatives is to become president of the United States. And if the Speaker of the House, something happens to him, this could happen. Or they wouldn't. And well, anything can happen. It could happen. If something happens to him, then the president pro tempore of the Senate is to be president of the United States. Section 3, Clause 6. The Senate shall have the sole power to trial impeachments. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation. When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside over the Senate. That means the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. And no person shall be convicted. That means thrown out of office, without the concurrence of two-thirds of the members present. Now, in this case, our Constitution tells the U.S. Senate how impeachment must occur, not by majority, not impeachment, conviction of a crime or misdemeanor and throw the man out of office. It takes a two-thirds vote of members present to throw a president out of office. Of course, he must have first been impeached. That means, by analogy, indicted as a grand jury would indict. The House of Representatives has the power of impeachment, which is the power of indictment, of binding the president or a judge or any office holder in the federal government, binding them over to the Senate to be tried and then thrown out of office if convicted. And by the letters, the word impeachment means to catch another person by the foot. That's what the word impeachment means. Again, an old Latin-rooted word. Catch them by the foot. Well, if you catch them by the foot, you hold on to them and hand them over to the Senate after you impeach them. Hand them over to the Senate so they can be tried, and if they're found guilty of whatever they're accused of. President Clinton was only the second president ever tried by the United States Senate, tried under this clause to be thrown out of office. And he missed being thrown out of office by one vote. The only other sitting president of the United States to be tried by the United States Senate to be thrown out of office was President Andrew Johnson, who was the vice president that took over after Abe Lincoln was shot to death. Well, they tried to impeach him. He was from Tennessee, and he thought, like Lincoln, he continued the policy of kindness toward the southern tiers of the states after the war. Well, the radicals in Congress didn't like that, and so they decided to throw him out of office. Now, they tried it. He was impeached by the House of Representatives, and then they bound him over to be tried by the Senate and removed from office. but they missed it by one vote, just as Clinton's impeachment missed by one vote.
Am I back?
I suppose. Yeah, I'm back. Gerard, you there?
Oh, man, I was having mic problems. I had to re-plug the thing and reboot.
Oh, that's fine.
We're almost done. I just want to get to one caller, this anonymous here. I think we missed him last time, so I'm going to just open him up. Just listen in case in case we need you, Brett. Okay.
Oh, very kind. I'm here.
Hello. Hello. State your name and your state. Is this anonymous? Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Oh, it's Crystal. How you doing, Crystal?
Fine. How you doing?
Good. Sound like you got a cold. Yeah, I just wake you up.
Yeah, you did. I've been nodding off. I went to the court again. I put that paper together for a final motion, you know, to dismiss. And when I went to the court today, because we had about 7-8 people, they wouldn't even call me. She goes, I told you not to come because we're not going to do nothing with this case at all. And she said, I have no jurisdiction. I'm not authorized to do anything with it, which none of the attorneys that wrote me the letter again, nobody showed up. So I heard something about an affidavit, and I did receive tonight when I got home 3 things from the appellate court. And they were signed off by the assistant clerk. So that 1938... which there's something going on with that letter, also the one I sent you, I guess with Mullet. So they're testifying about that, you know, that they have really, none of them have no jurisdiction. The 3 judges, they, again, I got my transcripts back. So the one that we wrote up, Jennings, who the retired judge, he recused himself. The other attorneys won't even speak. They don't, you know. And then this other firm they bought at me, they didn't show up. And then they sent me this Winkle, James Winkle, and he didn't show up today, you know. So I would just send those other papers and, you know, do not accept. And I'm going to send you, I got the transcript, which the transcript from 2000, I said, was it 14, 15, and the last two, I tell you, it's, everything is in there. And so, like, a few of them are following exactly what I'm doing, and they're getting the same response. And the other ones, as I said, you know, I'm doing it. I've just tried it out on myself. But I'm getting some pretty good progress.
Yeah, it seems to me that I don't care whether the federal courts wants this or not, the fact that you got a judge up there telling you that she has no jurisdiction should end the case right there. You say, good, then I'm going to move to this. It needs to go to federal court, and whether they like it or not.
Okay, that's what I'm saying.
So they can't give you remedy, basically. We were talking about you earlier with John. But look at Crystal.
Yeah, no.
John has got your paperwork, and he has an idea. We should talk in private to what the next step is here.
Absolutely. As I said, because I'm going to definitely get the transcripts. So everything I've done, the transcripts, which is all, there's so many things you just pull right out. And then I think it was very, very helpful. You know, because it's what we've been doing over the years, all the ideas that everybody put together. And when I put this in that, I was like, wow. She's like, no, we're not touching it. None of them are. Mm-hmm. And so what I've been doing with the other few people I've been working with, I said, well, take these points out. So I made copies of it. Okay.
Right.
The due process and all that other stuff. All righty.
Sounds good. We'll see what happens.
I'm just keeping
you
going.
You got to make the right moves here towards the end. I think you need to put the sword in the heart of the beast here. You know what I mean? They don't have a taste for it. You know what I mean? They're getting weak-kneed here because you've pushed it out so far, and they're looking bad. I think I think nobody wants to take responsibility.
Well, they're not. They're not going after this one because, as a matter of fact, the ironic thing, last week and today, the last courtroom is always jam-packed. There was only about six cases in there. They're, like, moving the cases out, you know. And when I walked in, she just mentioned my name right out, and they go, wow, they really know you, don't they?
Well, they want to do what they're doing nobody watching. That's what it is.
She's a new judge, but she was very, very pleasant, I have to say. You know? Very pleasant.
Well, they probably schooled her on Zoom, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure they did. But
you know?
But she's not playing those people's games either, because some of those old, good old boys attorneys, she's like, this is the way I run my court.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's good, Crystal. I'm glad to hear that they're waffling over your case. That's a good sign, you know.
Yeah.
But make sure.
And I got some more people coming in. That you know, every week I try to get at least 5 to 7 people. You know, about NLA.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you, Crystal. And look, I want to take this moment here to thank everybody who has contributed to my cause. My goodness, I feel like crying some of the envelopes I open. I want a special thanks to Felicia. Thank you, Felicia. I know you were waiting to get on, and we didn't get to you, but I'm going to give you a special thanks. And look, everybody who has given from the bottom of their hearts, whether it was a big amount or a small amount, I appreciate it all. So I want to just thank
you again.
Yes.
I heard you had an accident.
Yeah, my place burned down, and
oh my God.
We put an appeal out for people to help, and I'm just thanking everybody who responded and sent such generous gifts to me, and I just want to take that time to say thank you. I should do it in the beginning of the show.
When I get my pension, I'll send something.
Okay, honey. I didn't do it for that, but, you know, I just... Felicia was on, and I wanted to talk to her, and I wanted to give special mention to her because she was so generous to me, okay? And everybody else. Everybody's been very generous that has participated, and I really would like to thank the membership of NLA because it's overwhelming to me, you know, and such nice notes and everybody, you know, that has given from the bottom of their hearts. And I just want to recognize all of them. I won't even mention names. There's quite a few, you all know who you are. So thanks again. And God bless you. And you're in my prayers for sure. Okay. Well, we're going to end the show now. Thank you. Thank you, Crystal. And thank you, everybody. And we'll see you here. Same time, same station next week. Bye-bye.